They cannot take our pride. We
our turn. Hey, welcome to the broadcast. Peter Werby here with Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hello, Peter.
Yeah, what's the official ID, which we didn't give? This
what
is
think, okay. WRIF and WRIF HD1
something.
Detroit.
Yeah, absolutely.
That works.
We do a talk show every Sunday here, and we'd like you to join us at 248-544-WRIF.
It's 248-544-9743. Phone in talk show time.
Yeah, and check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall. We'll take your emails at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. What should we start with? Should we get the junk out of the way?
Let's get the junk out of the trunk.
Well, wait a minute. Before we get in the junk, let's do the Olympics. That was. Have you seen much of it? Quite amazing.
You know, I'm not a big Olympics kind of gal. You know, it's just not, I'm not really into sports. I know. Sorry. I mean, I love the Detroit teams, and that's kind of about it. I appreciate the figure skating. It's lovely. The opening ceremonies were just outrageous.
Talk about a spectacle.
I turned it on, and then I was like, oh, I can't watch this. Turned on. And I'm just kind of angry at Russia, so, you know, for their anti-gay stances.
Oh, I thought you were still mad at them for communism or something.
No, it doesn't go that far.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely reprehensible. And you know what I didn't actually send you? We send articles to one another that we may discuss. And things are going so in the opposite direction from what they are here in the United States with gay equality,
gay
marriage, gay rights. Yeah, in Africa, I don't have the article in front of me, but was like there's something like 56 countries. Could there be that many countries in Africa? But in other words, like 3/4 of them have anti-gay laws.
Yeah.
And it's not like the old American laws, like what they call the anti-sodomy laws.
Right.
And
some states still have that?
No, they actually.
It hasn't been too long.
But I think the 90s.
Yeah.
When there was
crazy.
A Texas law. Well, think about this. It was illegal for blacks to marry whites.
Until the 60s.
Until this is like 67.
God,
yeah. Yeah.
It's hard for me to wrap my liberal brain around that.
You know what was interesting?
Or, you know what? My loving brain around that.
Well, you gave my next sentence away.
Oh, see how we work together.
You know what the case was called? And again, I don't have this in front of me, but the person who sued the state of Virginia over their what they called anti-miscegenation, which meant black people and white people doing it. I don't think that even matters to anybody over 35 or 40, you know, but it used to. You know,
or under 35 or 40?
Under 35 or 40 for sure, and definitely under 30. But in any event, the person who brought the suit, their name was Loving.
Oh,
see, isn't that sweet?
Yeah, I like that.
That's a good thing.
And, you know, I'm glad that they had the guts to do it, because anyone who does something like sue for love or something like that in the midst of such hatred and so much history of racism and going back to slavery, anyone who actually goes out and does something like that, I just admire them so much. I mean, I worship them, honestly.
And in our case, what we're just talking about here, about people that struggled for so long to have people who had a different, what a weird phrase, sexual orientation, having to be recognized as full human beings. I don't get it. Don't they read, like, the Constitution and stuff like that?
You know? Well, they interpret the Constitution differently, or they don't even really care.
Well, yeah.
You know, they're just so caught in their world of hate and ignorance and fear. And prejudice. It's so much is fear-based. When it comes to things like that.
So what is happening, like in Russia, and what is happening in Africa, where mobs, both in Russia, and it's always right-wingers that are doing this, attacking gay activists in Russia, and it's even weirder and more dangerous in Africa, where mobs of people will try to kill gay people.
And I would like to say I'd be the one to stand up and fight against it, but I don't want to die. I would be out of there.
Well, you mean if you're gay and in Africa. Yeah. Well,
Russia.
And always, what do they base their hatred and their prejudice and their violence in? Their particular religious book, Christianity,
right,
or the Muslim religion,
yeah,
or something like
so
that.
So anyone who's, you know, if that religion is about acceptance and love and doing unto others, that is the exact opposite. What these people don't understand is that very fact right there. They're not showing what it's supposed to be about, even though some of the religions...
Never has been.
You know, I mean, there
some
are,
religious people do. I mean, there's all sorts of religious people and religious denominations that are all for marriage equality,
right,
and what have you.
Yeah. I'm just saying some in particular, you know. Anyway, so yeah, the backlash continues over there in Russia. There are people who are pretty PO'd about
anti-gay
stance. And a gay woman won a medal from Denmark, and she said, I would like to call myself, I'm from Denmark. I'm a woman from Denmark. I'm an athlete.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to focus on that. But there are five openly gay athletes who are participating in the Olympics, but they'd prefer to focus on, you know, winning the medal,
sure,
and they can talk about it later. But they're opening. Only five.
Well, that are open.
That's what,
right,
I mean.
Yeah. One time I interviewed Craig Covey, who had just been elected mayor of Ferndale, and I said I wanted to welcome him to the broadcast as Michigan's first gay mayor. And he said, let me correct you. I said, oh, there's been others. He said, no, I'm the first openly gay.
Yeah, I remember that. That's good.
Mayor. But as long as we put adjectives in front of human beings, we're still not there. If we have to identify people by their race or their gender or their what have you, we're still...
Sexuality.
We got a ways to go. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, fortunately, Alaska. I get my social causes mixed up. I think Alaska was the marijuana. Aren't they thinking about legalizing marijuana in
Alaska?
So.
You would think so. They're you know, rugged individualism and all of that. Hey, are the Pussy Riot women, are they gay? Do you know?
I don't know. I have no idea.
No, that's right. They're married. A couple of them are married.
To men. You got to qualify
that. These days. Right. But did you see them on Stephen Colbert?
I didn't watch it. I still need to watch that, as a matter of fact, but I read about it.
I forgot. It's both on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and also on our Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall. And they speak in Russian, and then Stephen Colbert, who's posing as a right-winger, that's his shtick, is interviewing him and saying he's a friend of Putin's, you know, that he's
he's something else. Well, to kind of clarify for people who don't know what we're talking about, this is a band of women in Russia based out of Moscow who went in front of the...
Went into an Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox cathedral, a Christian Eastern Orthodox, and did, like, I think something like 80 seconds of this anti-Putin song that they did.
And went to jail.
And the two of them, Nadezhda Tolokonova and Maria Aliokhina.
Aliokhina
were spent, I think about 20 months in jail. And then with the Olympics coming up, Putin released them, to which they were angry. I mean, because they knew it was a public relations stunt.
Yeah.
And
that's how hardcore they are.
And it sort of backfired on them because they've been out front talking about how bad Russia's prisons are and denouncing the anti-gay laws in Russia. And I don't...
might want to just stay out of Russia because they were here in the U.S.
Yeah.
We will have them here. We'd love to have them here.
Well, they were in the United States for a benefit for Amnesty International.
Yeah.
And I forgot all who was there, but at least Madonna, who introduced them.
Yeah. Lauryn Hill was there. The Flaming Lips.
Which Yoko Ono is in.
She is?
Yeah.
No.
Thought she was.
Maybe she performed with the Flaming Lips.
I think she did. She performed with them. Yeah. The Flaming Lips with Yoko Ono. Blondie, Cake, The Fray, Tegan and Sarah. Right. They'd spent 21 months in penal colonies for the crime of hooliganism.
You know what? If we were there, we would probably be put in jail for hooliganism.
Yeah, well, I guess if you make a commotion, like if we went into a church and started... acting out, I suppose we you know, we would get arrested for trespassing or
disturbing like the public.
Something like that. Yeah. I don't think there were.
I wouldn't do it though.
No, and they wear these Pussy Riot girls wear these. What would you call them? Balaclavas? Is that what it is?
I don't know.
That cover all you see is like the eyes and the mouth.
It's similar to a burqa, right?
No. Not at all. I forgot what their names are. It's actually on my site. They have two easier names to pronounce for the, you know, us.
Americans.
Yeah, we can get our, at least me, get our Nadia and Masha. Yeah, they've been expelled from Pussy Riot. Did you see that?
No.
Yeah. They actually, it's pretty
interesting. The two most outspoken ones have
been?
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay, so the other ones kind of backed down.
Yeah, they said the other women, Kat, Garajda, Farah, Shaba, Serafina, and Schumacher, the group said that selling concert tickets using the collective's name, this was for the Amnesty International mm-hmm. benefit, was highly contradictory to the principles of Pussy Riot, where a female separatist collective, I don't know what that means, we never accept money for our performances, we only stage illegal performances in unexpected public places.
Female separatism usually is related directly to lesbianism, so sure. I don't know if these are the only two straight members.
Maybe.
That's
yeah.
my thought.
Yeah. They, in fact, there. If anybody has HBO or any other way to get these, there is a documentary called Pussy Riot, A Punk Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a big fan of documentaries. But
I love documentaries.
Well, this is wonderful.
Okay.
This
well, I don't have HBO, but I'll find it somewhere else.
So Pussy Riot, the two most outspoken members, gone. Actually, but they said they are no longer Pussy Riot. And they say, we have lost two friends, two ideological teammates, but the world has gained two brave rights activists.
So I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they got expelled.
So bye-bye, but hey, you're still doing a good thing.
Yeah. All right. So we should always do like the good, the bad, and the ugly. So that's the good. And we got a lot of bad.
Well, the ugly.
Should we go right to the ugly? Should we go right to the ugly?
It's ugly.
This is very ugly.
How do these things happen?
I don't know.
Okay, first of all,
go ahead. I'm almost
speechless. There was a supposed celebrity boxing match that was set up going between rapper DMX and guess who? George Zimmerman. Yeah, remember him? The guy who was acquitted of killing, murdering Trayvon Martin?
Kid. Yeah.
So then there's this promoter who gets this together, when I heard it, I thought, George Zimmerman is a celebrity?
You know, thank you, because that's
to choke.
That's what jumped out at me, the fact that they said it was a celebrity boxing match. Here's a man that shot to death, an unarmed kid, you know, this grown man with his,
And there's no question whether he shot him to death or not.
Yeah, Let's keep that
at the forefront.
But, the story I have, it's been canceled, by the way.
Yeah, and the reason it's been canceled, there was so much backlash toward the promoter.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was so much. And there's change.org. I think maybe it was like a million people signed a petition. And he just got so much backlash that he said, you know what? I'm in this business to make money, but not at this cost.
That's what the promoter said?
Oh, yes, he did.
What a wonderful man.
Yes, and DMX is known for getting in a little bit of trouble here and there, and I think it was maybe a few months ago he got out of prison, some kind of weapons charge. He didn't kill anyone or anything. He just was stupid and had a gun in the wrong place.
Yeah. This story I have says that it's not BMX, but some rapper.
DMX, not BMX.
BMX, it's something else. DMX, yeah, thank you.
It's a bike.
Yeah, I know. What do I know from rappers? But anyway.
I know, actually, but here, I know a lot about rap.
All right,
so.
Well, here's what he said. George Zimmerman just can't stay out of the news and is not now agreed. This has been canceled, but it said agreed to a celebrity boxing match.
Celebrity!
For charity. Yeah, you shoot somebody to death and you're a celebrity. One person.
This country is so messed up in our own way.
Likely send a message to address, to that address. What address? Anyways, is, the rapper, The Game. And he said, I will beat the expletive out of him. I would not be boxing for me. I'd be boxing for the legacy of Trayvon Martin and for his family. I would box him to knock him out. I would definitely take pleasure in it. It's legal, and I want to show him you can solve your disputes without a weapon.
So, and I bet most rappers would like to beat the crap out of George Zimmerman.
Well,
and a lot of other just...
Yeah.
I'd like to beat the crap out of George Zimmerman.
So what's the deal between... Where's this guy, the Game, come in? The Game is almost 6.5 feet tall, weighs 240 pounds.
He was probably just adding comment in addition to... Cause it, yeah.
And has a tattoo of Trayvon Martin on his leg.
Right on.
Yeah.
So that's the stupid and the ugly.
Well, we can... let me see. Maybe we should do something that we don't frequently do, and that's talk about our city, right?
We do talk about it. You know what? How about Belle Isle? I think we should talk about Belle Isle. The state took over Belle Isle today. It's now officially a state park. It's $11 for an entire year if you do it through your driver's license,
mm-hmm.
which are your license plates. You know how you can add the park? You have that, don't you?
I do.
Yeah.
And I think it's terrible that Detroiters, where the income level is so low, are being forced to now pay for what was free.
I agree with that, but, I mean, you've spent a lot of time there, Peter, and so
you know what they should do?
The only time that it's clean is when there's the Grand Prix, okay? And they're already making improvements. They've put new tops on the shelters. They're already...
No. I think it's good that they're doing it.
Yeah.
They shouldn't have to pay for it. They shouldn't have to pay. I mean, because...
But it is a state park.
Because what it's going to essentially do is keep poorer people off the island. I mean, even $11 a year isn't going to work. And let me say that all entrance to all state parks, like you don't have the William Milliken State Park, which is down at the riverfront at the Rivard, what do they call it? Right at the foot of Rivard where there's that merry-go-round and all that. You can walk right onto the Milliken State Park and there's no fee.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'd be willing to pay like $20 a year. Wow, man, ain't I a sport? $20 a year. What does that come out to a day?
I mean, like it's that. Kind of one way or the other. Like, there's good and there's bad about it. So I guess that's
the only bad thing.
Yeah.
A lot of Detroiters felt that this, like, the imposition of this emergency financial manager, which essentially who has become the dictator of Detroit,
mm-hmm.
Is, you know, working out a deal where he can pay off the people that in a large part caused the misery of Detroit, or just in general what happens to different sectors of world capitalism and local capitalism. So there's sacrifice zones and sacrifice classes and sacrifice races, and it all depends on where you fall on the scale of misery or privilege.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. Like, for instance, Puerto Rico. Did you know that Puerto Rico is in awful shape?
No, I didn't. And I've been to Puerto Rico, but it's been a few years.
They say they have a slow-motion economic crisis and skidded to a new low last week when Standard & Poor's downgraded its debt to junk status. And in the past 8 years, Puerto Rico's ticker tape of woes has stretched unabated, $70 billion in debt, a 15.5% unemployment rate, a soaring cost of living, pervasive crime, crumbling schools, and a worrisome exodus of professionals and middle-class Puerto Ricans who are coming to the United States. And who are coming to the mainland since they're United States citizens. Right.
I do recall. I was all over, you know. I was in on the resort, and then I was in the downtown, and then I went to the rainforest. What is that called there?
Oh, yeah. No, I can't remember, but I know what you're talking
about.
Where
the coquille frogs are. And then I remember we had a cab driver, and I told her what I do, you know, what I do for a living, and she wanted to show me parts. So I did see a lot of the poverty as well.
Sure. Schools sit shuttered either because of disrepair or because of a dwindling number of students. This is the United States. Well, I guess it's not the United States. It's America because it's, a territory, right? Let me see.
I believe
it's the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, isn't it? Well, the Commonwealth isn't doing too well. In this typical convivial capital, which means nice place, communities have erected gates and bars to help thwart carjackers and home invaders, illegal drugs, including high-level narco-trafficking, and are one of the, which is one of the few growth industries. They're about 1,000 miles from Mississippi. The per capita income is about $15,000, half that of Mississippi, the poorest state. 37% of all households receive food stamps. In Mississippi, the total is 22%. And increasingly, it is put in the same breath as Detroit. So what's going on here?
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What's going on here? You know,
not that I'm surprised, but I'd never heard that before.
If you read it in a, this word is not any longer having the power that it should have. But if you read this script in a racist way, you see people of color, people of Puerto Rican people, and in Detroit, black people. People that, quote, can't manage their own affairs, that somehow they inherent in their makeup, they wind up in poverty. Well, there's other explanations for this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
the one that I always go back to, I mean, I feel like a broken record sometimes, but, you know, this country is like a caste system, like in India. What you are born into in the main is you'll stay kind of right around there. People come up out of it all the time. I didn't say the word. I meant yes.
Oh.
I didn't say the word.
Oh, my God.
It was a...
Here goes my radio career.
No. The S went before the Y. Mm. But, yes, they come up out of it all the time. But the percentage of people who come up out of it, it's very small.
It's very small. It is indeed. Although there was a study that said, upward mobility has not declined. Because, like a lot of people say, well, you know, that upward mobility is becoming less and less possible, and that we have this great income disparity. Well, both things are true. There is growing massive income inequality and disparity. And at the same time, upward mobility has not declined. It's just never been really great.
Yeah.
Just what you're saying. I mean, this affirms what you're saying, essentially.
Percentage-wise, it's very small.
Based on tens of millions of anonymous tax records, finds that the mobility rate has held largely steady in recent decade, although it remains lower than in Canada and in much of Western Europe, where the odds of escaping poverty are higher. And we talk about this frequently because when you think about it, think real quickly without getting any big analysis. Why are people poor? People say, well, they don't have education. They're lazy. And the Republicans' new mantra is it's more comfortable not to work than it is to work because the government, what's that guy's name that used to be the governor, Huckleberry, what's his name?
What?
Who? Something like that. Don't start me laughing.
Finn? Huckleberry Finn? I have no idea who you're talking about.
I'm about to press the button to go to, it was the governor of Arkansas, and now he's a common...
Oh, Huckabee.
Huckabee. Okay.
Huh?
Yeah. I even forgot what he was saying.
I don't know either.
You got me off. But what they're on about is, I remember he called it the government Uncle Sugar. But he was talking about women, one of part of the Republican right-wing war on women remarks that come. They just can't stop these guys from making these remarks like that. But the idea is that, first off, the poor are responsible for their low status in society. Because this is America. Anybody can become rich, which is true. But most people don't.
Yeah.
And then 99% of people that aren't rich aren't going to become rich.
And then think about the state of things now. That's definitely not happening.
Sure. And the lack of education, the lack of skills. You can have all the skills and all of the... Well, I mean, you know, it's weird because as an individual, you can become... And everybody knows somebody like this and everybody hears about it. They used to call it in the 19th century, there was this little sort of morality tale about this guy, Horatio Alger. And he climbed from the bottom. And a lot of times immigrants like Andrew Carnegie, who wound up owning U.S. Steel, came from Scotland, eh?
Hey.
And just became the equivalent of a billionaire. And a lot of Tom Monahan from Domino's Pizza. I mean, there's all these examples that you could say. But those are actually what they call the exception, which proves the rule.
Right.
Most people don't do that. In fact, most people that begin poor, I'm not talking about working class, but I'm talking about poor, they're a chance of even getting into the working class is limited, and close to nil to get into the middle class, and zero, about statistically zero to become, you know, the 1%.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some that do it, but statistically, it's, you know.
Statistically, most of these people are working three jobs to try to put food on the table.
Yeah. So, let's see, of the island, this is back to Puerto Rico, 3.67 million people, only 1 million people work in the formal economy. And this is the way it was in the 19th century, and all of the reforms of the 20th century that took place are beginning to go down the drain. And what the role of conservatives, and because they never were happy, remember, they fought every single reform, They wanted to keep child labor, keep 8-year-olds in factories. They wanted to keep the 12-hour day. They didn't want a minimum wage. They didn't want Social Security. They didn't want, there was what they called the progressive era at the beginning of the 20th century, where they actually put in things like the Meat Inspection Act and antitrust to try to stop these corporations from dominating industries. And there was a little bit of a mixed bag, but in the main, the conservatives want to do what? They always want to conserve exactly what is.
Or how they want it. How they, you know, because not everything is exactly how they desire it to be.
If you really parse through who a good deal of these conservatives are, they would really be back to the origins of this country, where it was run by white propertied males.
Right.
Yeah. Because, hey, got some good examples. Well, George Washington. Oh, yeah, he had slaves, didn't he?
Right. Well, it's a little thing called white privilege.
Yeah. Okay, well, I was going to start off, though, on this thing about this new stadium. Well, actually, this huge entertainment district.
Five-block area.
I think it's more than that.
Oh.
I don't know. We'll review the documents as we take a break.
We're talking about the Red Wings.
Yeah, yeah.
Complex.
If you if you're on hold, hang on, and we'll be right back to you and let you know what's going to happen with this enormous downtown development. And guess who's paying the bill?
Make your opinion heard. Call us at our new number, 248-544-WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Weekend is brought to you by Modern Family. Watch weeknights at 7:30 and 10:30 on CW50. The Rick.
Is breakfast really the most important meal of the day? At Buffalo Wild Wings, we think a case can be made for lunch. Think about it. Award-winning hand-spun wings in 16 signature sauces and 5 seasonings, buffalitos, wraps, burgers, and salads. Yeah, we're thinking that's a pretty good argument. Now throw in the fact that we've got over 50 big screens to watch all the sports you'll ever want. It's officially a no-brainer. So next time, make lunch your game-winning meal.
Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Get everything that rocks on your smartphone. Dave and Chuck the Freak, the Rock Girl, the Riff Man Cave, and more. Oh, yeah, you can listen live, too. Download the 101 WRIF app for your iPhone or Android today from the App Store or Google Play Store. Brought to you in part by the Specs Howard School of Media Arts. Specs Howard's one-year programs in graphic design, broadcast, or digital media arts sharpen your creative edge. Find out more at SpecsHoward.edu or call 248-358-9000.
Listen up, everybody. This is Flo with a Progressive Insurance Alert. Don't even try to change that channel. I'm on all of them. So, you already know Snapshot rewards our customers for their good driving. Well, now anyone can test drive Snapshot for free, even if you have insurance with another company. See how much you could save before you switch your insurance. Also, I'm offering kazoo lessons on Saturdays.
Test drive Snapshot today. Visit progressive.com/snapshot. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Snapshot not available in all states.
When I grow up, I want to be a new pair of blue jeans.
When I grow up, I want to be a kid's first computer.
When I grow up, I want to be a glass countertop in a new home.
When I grow up, I want to be a kid's best birthday present.
When I grow up, I want to be a football stadium.
When I grow up, I want to be a warm place on a cold day.
When I grow up, I want to be a fancy backsplash.
I want to be a bike that races around the
country. When I grow up,
I want to be a bench on a forest
when I grow
trail.
Up. I want to be a rocking chair on
when
a sunny
I grow up,
porch.
I want to be a skyscraper.
I want to be a...
I want to be a...
All the
I
want to
be,
be, be, be,
be...
I want to be...
I want to be...
I want to be...
I want
to be...
I want to be...
When I grow up, I don't want to be a piece of garbage. And if you recycle me, I won't be.
Give your garbage another life. Recycle. Learn how at iwanttoberecycled.org. A public service advertisement brought to you by Keep America Beautiful and the Ad Council.
101 WRIF.
We take this to the next level. Oh, yeah.
The Riff. WRIF and WRIF
HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much. Give us a call, 248-544-WRIF.
248-544-9743.
Or if you like, you can email us the way that Christopher did. We were talking about Belle Isle, and I was saying I like everything about the state taking over this great island park that I spend quite a bit of time on during the summer, yeah, during the warmer weather. But I said the idea that they are going to charge Detroiters, who often tend to be poor, even $11 a year, just I don't think should be. But Christopher reminds us you can walk or bike onto the island for free, which is good, except you know, most people come there, they're going to have
coolers and things like that.
And stuff like that. Yeah, for sure. But
I wonder how much it is to go, like, if you don't do the yearly pass.
Oh, you mean a one-time?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I hope they have that. All right. John from Livonia has been waiting for quite a while. And we'll talk about the new Ilitch Stadium as soon as we get John on the air. John, thanks for being so patient. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you very much. I want to say hello to Julian Jordan. She prompted me to call. I talked to her earlier today, and so here I am calling.
John, hello.
What I want to talk about is Chris Christie. You know, he went down to Florida, and the governor didn't want any photo ops with anybody but, you know, just him and Christie. No photo ops, you know. And then when he went to Texas, he got a kind of chilly reception there. You think Christie's presidential chances are over even before they begun?
Yes.
Well, I would say, too, John, let's just quickly remind people. Chris Christie is the governor of New Jersey, and he's caught in this scandal called Bridgegate, where he's this very vindictive guy. I mean, he just acts and looks like a bully to me. And he's just throwing everybody under the bus. And what he did was he created this traffic jam on the George Washington Bridge. I think it's like the world's busiest bridge to screw up this mayor. I don't even know how it screwed up the mayor of Fort Lee, New Jersey. You know, they said there should be a traffic problem on the bridge.
The mayor decided he didn't want to endorse him.
Yeah, but I don't get why.
Because that's where the bridge spills out.
So,
right?
I mean, people would be angry at him.
That's their logic.
Right. So he actually was who the big money in the Republican Party was looking to put forth as a candidate to Hillary Clinton. Because he actually had some, if you will, appealing characteristics that are lost on all the other, Huckleberry, whatever his name is.
Huckabee,
and who else is even in there? The crazy son of,
Ron Paul's son, Rand. Bobby Jindal, is he still in there?
Yeah. I mean, so they got a pack of losers, right? And I think the Democrats are gleeful that this has all happened to Chris Christie. And also, who would have been the closest thing the Republicans have now to a moderate, although he's still like a far right winger given his social policies and what have you. But, to get somebody like Huckabee in there to have that kind of voice in the public dialogue, in the political dialogue, is really toxic. I mean, it was like having...
it's toxic, but maybe that's good for the other side.
Well, it is good for the other side, but what happens is, I mean, think about how the way in 2008, how John McCain and... I'm so pleased when I can't think of people's names like that. Sarah Palin.
SP.
Yeah, SP, when they got trounced, yet still she had a voice in some people. I mean, think about some of those rallies where people were yelling racist remarks and what have you. It gives what social space to what people should just kind of keep to their own damn self.
Or try to evolve already.
Yeah. All right, John.
Thank you, John.
Thanks
for calling.
Appreciate it. All right, well, let's get this one more. Here's Alan from Pontiac. Alan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Alan? Oh, you got to click.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I didn't do it. I thought I did. Hey, Alan. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, how you doing, sir? My name's Alan. I was just highly appreciating the show you guys have on Sunday nights and just wanted to say I like your show and I don't have much I want to say, but... good to hear you guys every Sunday night. I've listened to you guys for about a year, but I just wanted to say that you guys have a good show, and I listen to your station a lot. So,
well, thank you, Alan.
Well, thank you so
much. And, you know, I mean, everybody in showbiz has big egos, so that's great to hear you say that. We love it.
Yeah. You speak for yourself, Peter. I'm not kidding. Alan, don't lump me in that big ego thing. I'm one of the DJs and talk show hosts that honestly does not have a huge ego.
Alan, she has a bigger ego than I
do. I do not. So full of it. I really don't.
All right.
The minute you get a big old ego like that, then all of a sudden, bam, you're gone.
All right. Thank you, Alan. Really appreciate it. Yeah. And someone's going to listen and say, why are they talking about eagles? All right. Detroit. Detroit City Council voted to allow the Detroit Downtown Development Authority to lease 39 parcels of land to Olympia Development of Michigan, which is owned by billionaire Mike Ilitch, for the price of $1. It's a 35-year lease, and it's a giveaway, essentially, to Ilitch, who plans to develop a 45-block, you said five, a 45-block entertainment district.
How did I miss the four in front of the five? Because I thought five sounded huge.
Yeah, complete with a new hockey arena, in that he owns the Detroit Red Wings, the hockey team here in Detroit, if you're listening elsewhere. And there's been this huge giveaway to Ilitch and also to Dan Gilbert, another billionaire. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, you know, I'm not like going to condemn them completely, particularly Gilbert. But the idea that now our fate is in the hands of the lords of the land, that what like Massachusetts and Puerto Rico, we were saying, they have what they call their states are called not the state of Massachusetts. It's called the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And it doesn't mean that all the wealth is held in common, but that there's an idea that the government.
Is it for the people? Is it
for
supposed
the people?
To be?
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. But instead, here, we have to depend on the largesse of these billionaires. And in addition to handing Ilitch land worth millions of dollars for nothing, about
that is pretty astounding.
60% of the construction costs of the stadium, some $285 million, will be funded with public. This is both for this stadium and the what they call this catalyst development. It's going to be funded with public money through the state government's Michigan Strategic Fund. The project, estimated at $650 million, raises an obvious question. How can politicians, I'm reading from an article, which, I don't even have where it's from. I think it's from our friend Tom Stevens, who has been a guest on the show, previously a lawyer for the city of Detroit. So let's say it's Tom's. Tom, I hope it's yours. How can politicians claim the city is so broke that the health benefits and pensions of retirees must be slashed, yet hundreds of millions of dollars can be found for Ilitch's entertainment district?
Yeah. Well, and I think that a lot of people are excited about it because it's putting something big and it's bringing people downtown.
Sure. And, well, people can say, isn't this going to help? Isn't this like sort of what they call pump priming? Isn't this Keynesian economics where the government actually pumps money into the economy, which then has this accelerator effect, and it will provide jobs, and it'll be wealth creation and all that. Well, a couple of things occur to me. If these guys are billionaires, why don't they just write a check?
Because they can write a
check. I mean, think about this.
I know they're writing checks for other things in their defense in downtown Detroit.
Yeah, I mean, they are.
You know, they bought a bunch of police and fire trucks and things like that. A lot of the business owners.
I mean, it's a little inconceivable to think about what it means to have $1 billion.
I know. Well, no, it's way inconceivable for me.
So, like Mike Ilitch, who say he has only $1 billion.
Okay.
And he financed the whole thing, $650 million. He'd have $350 million left.
And guess what?
Yeah.
He could make another billion in the next couple of years.
Yeah. But, all right, so this is the way the deal is. So why don't we just say that this is all going to help, won't it? Won't it help the city of Detroit?
I think that getting people downtown might help a little, right?
Yeah. Well, numerous reports have shown that far from bringing economic renewal, such development projects amount to handouts to powerful corporate and financial interests, which come at the expense of funding for public schools and other services. What few jobs are created are chiefly insecure and low paying.
Oh, well, yeah.
Yeah. But, well, you know, this is all liberal stuff. Well, how about this? The free market Cato Institute wrote, despite the beliefs of local officials and their hired consultants about the economic benefits of public subsidized stadium construction, the consensus of economic, of academic economists have been that such policies do not raise income. Subsidies of sports facilities may actually reduce the incomes of the alleged beneficiaries.
Really?
Yeah.
Reduce incomes? What about people who don't have a job?
Well, they can't even get a guarantee. They wanted the, some people on the council that voted against the Detroit City Council said they wanted guarantees that a certain number of jobs would go to Detroiters.
Yes. Yeah, I saw that.
Didn't happen.
Hmm.
It didn't happen.
Well, I don't know. I mean, this is a touchy one right there. I don't know. I'm sure. All over the place about it.
Illich himself has benefited massively from government largesse in the past, receiving a subsidy of $115 million and also $189 million for the construction of Comerica Park, the home field of his professional baseball team, the Detroit Tigers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, of course, he might as well... Just keep on going, right, when you're someone with all that money.
Yeah. During the past several years, while simultaneously slashing aid to the city of Detroit, the state government in Lansing has paid an average of $6.65 billion per year in subsidies to businesses.
Really?
Yeah. Well, what they do is they give them, they say, okay, if you stay here, if you come here, we'll give
incentives.
You
incentives.
Yeah. And so they can essentially blackmail different municipalities into who's going to pay it, or they say, well, you know, actually we got an offer from Pennsylvania for our factory.
So okay. this in fact is happening.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Overall, U.S. corporations receive $80 billion in subsidies annually from states, counties, and cities.
My gosh.
So those of you who say, you know, I hate all these people on welfare and it's an incentive not to work and they're taking my money.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing like this. Nothing like $80 billion.
Yeah, exactly. And I always go back to people who are on government assistance. They're not out there like la-da-da-da-da-da, life is good, you know? They're not eating caviar and lobster tails. I mean, they're struggling. They're barely getting by. And then with this new farm bill that is... been signed.
Sure.
Now, in the next how many years? Eight, how many billion dollars worth of
cutting it off for hundreds of thousands of people are going to have their food stamps. And but what does it say to us where we have a society that actually needs that kind of aid just to have a standard of living that most of us would like to take for granted? Right?
And it's not even a high standard of living. I mean, I know people who live on government assistance, and I have for many years on and off, you know, if people come in and out of my life. And it's like, okay, we can get the fresh food at the beginning of the month, and then the rest of the time we're eating canned food, and we're going to stretch it as far as we can. We're going to do rice and beans. They're not living a great life.
No, and by the way,
they're struggling.
This farm bill continues to give billions of dollars of subsidies to millionaire farming corporations.
Yeah, it's not about, you know, old Mr.
McDonald.
Old McDonald, yeah. Down the road, E I E I O.
Or Farmer Huckleberry. Or
the farmer in the Dell.
Yeah, anything. E I E I O. Yeah, you said that, didn't you?
Yeah.
So in the meantime, in June 2012, the Detroit fire chief announced the permanent closure of 15 of the city's fire companies, fired 164 firefighters, and demoted 200 more. These cuts place enormous strain on the firefighters, who typically battle several fires per shift. And together with all the other city retirees, Detroit firefighters now face major reductions to their health benefits and pensions under emergency manager Kevin Orr's restructuring plan that is soon to be released.
Inexcusable.
Yeah. So I don't understand. Well, what do you think? I mean, is this good? Because I think I'm trying to. I know what you're saying, Julian. Because in a way, I think the land that I know that goes between Charlotte Street and down to I-75.
Okay.
You know, right before the Fox, right before Hockey Town, you know, and the Fox, and yeah, I mean it'll bring the city alive. But what it does,
it gives rich people a place to go.
Well, and it gives us suburbanoids, a destination, because that's where I spend three quarters, I would say more increasingly, 80-85% of my time, my leisure time in Detroit, restaurants, bars.
You do more than I do just because I'm kind of stay home a lot.
You spend 85% of your time at home.
I'm safe and warm and happy there.
Yeah. That's what my wife said.
You tried to get me out Friday night so hard. I'm like, nope.
What did we see?
You went down, wasn't it a Cuban?
Oh, no, it wasn't Cuban. No, it was a percussion group.
Yeah.
That was the most, it was at the Detroit Institute of Arts. By the way, folks, you are paying, you all, everyone listening in, what is it, Macomb, doesn't go to Washington. No, it's Macomb, Oakland, and Wayne County. Are paid members of the Detroit Institute of Arts because you're paying a county tax that was agreed to by the.
It's
the
free. It's free. In other words,
so you can get in there.
In simpler terms, the only thing that you can't get for free are the special exhibits that they bring
exactly.
in.
Exactly. So if you go, for instance, to DIA.org and you go to something called Friday Night Live, and if you're really just a hardcore rocker, there might be some things there that you want to go to. But the other times, they've got great rock and roll there. They've got classical music.
They have a lot of international music.
They have international music. Yeah. And so this time they had this, it was called, something squared. I can't remember what it was. Or something cubed.
Okay.
Or square cubed.
Round?
Yeah, round, cubed, square. But they did. One of the things I like I would not like to see like a 3-hour concert of that, you know?
Right.
But it is unusual.
I can't sit still for that long except when I'm doing a radio show.
Well, could you do it like for an hour? It was
yes.
about 50 minutes. Yeah. So sometimes I'm thinking, I'm seeing things there and I'm thinking, but it's unusual. It's an unusual experience. And the Detroit Institute of Arts, I was looking at, I was just waiting for my wife who was in the bathroom or something. And I'm looking and I'm going.
So you were waiting a long time.
I was waiting
a
long time.
She's kind of pokey.
Yeah. Yeah. Watch it. She's listening.
No, she's not. Yeah, she never listens to us.
The art there, if you pick up an art book and you look through there, you'll see these paintings that are hanging on the walls there. And one of the things I was thinking,
famous paintings from extremely famous artists throughout history. It's so incredible.
I was standing right looking at this Van Gogh self-portrait, and there was Monet, and I'm trying to think, I mean, they have them all kind of mixed in. Randomly, not entirely, but in any event, there was no guards there. They weren't behind glass because people, steal stuff.
There are guards around and they have cameras. If you get too close to those paintings, boom, someone's right there. I've seen it happen.
Well, yeah.
Don't breathe too heavily on them either.
There's some that you go, and if you cross a line, it starts beeping.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, let's do this.
And I've been to the Louvre in Paris, which things are, the Mona Lisa, things are way more protected than that. This is very accessible art.
Hey, one final thing here about this, and I'd like to hear from you about this new planned downtown development of the entertainment district put together by...
And a new Red Wings Arena.
New Red Wings Arena. I think in a way...
Is it necessary? That's what I wonder what people think.
I think the whole idea of developing that whole area is very good. But why in the world does a billionaire need public funding? That's what I...
Yeah, why are you getting something sold... Two for a dollar.
Yeah, and plus, in order to, the city has to do, and the state has to do major infrastructure building, roads and all this stuff. All right, final thing.
The street lights. I want to talk about street lights at some point and the experience I had last night coming home from the Pistons game.
We'll do that when we come back. But just the final word on this. Two faces of austerity and corrupt cronyism meet at City Hall. Poverty of the urban working class and collapsing economies under stage, and not coincidentally, lavish public subsidies for billionaires. Wow.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call.
Whether it's a serious fall, fire danger, or other type of home emergency, Life Alert is there for you. The company, with its slogan, "Help, I've fallen and I can't get up," protects its members. Here are some of them.
When you have a heart attack like I did, and there's no one there, Life Alert was there for me.
Having a secure feeling through Life Alert is ideal.
My independence is possible because of it.
Now, Life Alert can also protect you in a fire emergency with a system that automatically notifies our monitoring center.
Thanks to Life Alert, you can live alone without ever being alone.
With Life Alert protection, elderly people can avoid or delay going into a nursing facility. For a free brochure about Life Alert service, call now. 1-800-404-2454. That's 1-800-404-2454. Call Life Alert now for your free brochure at 1-800-404-2454.
This is your Car Care Minute. With more folks taking driving vacations this year, the pros at the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence offer the following tips to help you arrive at your destination safely. First, review your owner's manual and follow the recommended service schedules. Be certain to check the level and concentration of the cooling system. Check your tires for wear and pressure, and be sure your heating and air conditioning systems are operating efficiently. If you've been experiencing performance problems such as hard starts, rough idling, or stalling, now's the time to have your vehicle serviced by a certified automotive technician. It's extra insurance against an annoying breakdown while on vacation. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
License and registration.
But I'm walking.
Do you want to upset an officer of the law?
No, sir.
Good. I pulled you over today for littering.
I didn't litter.
Wow. That's what they all say. Unfortunately, I saw you drop a pair of thunder thighs a few blocks back. Probably happened as you were biting into that apple you're holding.
How did you know they're my thunder thighs?
Well, my young friend, I'd like to say 2 years and the police academy helped figure it out. But between us, it was smallstep.gov.
Smallstep.gov?
Yep, Rooney. It's this site with tons of easy ways to lose weight. Some steps are so easy, people don't realize they're doing them. Like you taking small step number 83, snack on fruits. Go to smallstep.gov, you'll see. You can drive off now.
I'm still walking.
Take a small step to get healthy at smallstep.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Exercise is hard. So is maintaining a healthy diet. Of course, neither is half as hard as dying. Sadly, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and stroke kill nearly a million people a year. Even sadder, most of these deaths are preventable with a few lifestyle changes, including regular activity, healthier eating, and not smoking. Talk to your doctor about your risk for type 2 diabetes and heart disease. And if your doctor recommends lifestyle changes or medication, listen. The reason so many die is because not enough are willing to change. You can stop it, starting right now. It's your life. Listen to your doctor. Eat better. Get moving. Visit checkupamerica.org or call 1-800-DIABETES. A message from the American Diabetes Association.
Great news, Detroit!
Keep your fitness resolution. Hit WRIF.com and see Meltdown in action at Planet Fitness. See how easy it is in the no-judgment zone with a Planet Fitness trainer. You could even win a Planet Fitness membership at WRIF.com. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Every hour is happy hour.
Everything that rocks.
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Ritz award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. Welcome to Monday. What were you mouthing to me, or is this something we shouldn't say on the air?
Continue on.
Okay. The number here, 248-544-WRIF, if you'd like to get on the air. We have a number of people On hold, please wait. We are going to get to you in just about a second. In numeric non-letters, it is...
2489... Wait, 248-544-9743.
Yeah. Join us on Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall. My website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And I'll have two interesting interviews that I did recorded previously at 1 a.m. Michael writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We were talking about Governor Chris Christie. He said he is a gluttonous thug. The fact that he was elected governor is evidence of the stupidity of New Jersey's voters.
There you go.
Wow.
Speak, my friend.
I don't think he liked it. Now, Jalene, you were saying you were coming home from the Pistons game, and what happened?
Well, I was astounded, and I saw something on the news this morning about it. We're talking about the lighting in Detroit, let alone you come up I-75 coming south from Palace of Auburn Hills. It was absolutely pitch dark.
Yeah,
it was so frightening. I was really just white-knuckled driving, and I was like the little old lady in the right lane doing 50, you know?
They're actually talking now about putting in more lights, and they're going
to... They need to get on that. It is dangerous.
It is.
I just wanted to speak out about that.
All right, let's grab a call from California. Here's Mike in California. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, this is originally the Mike from Fenton, but we moved to California because things were so bad out there in Detroit. But we're really doing good out here.
Well,
so
good.
It's really good to hear from you.
The other way around, but go ahead. Same at you. Yeah. Go ahead. What's up?
Yeah. So, hi, Julian.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling. Yeah. What's going on?
You guys, like usual, Monday morning.
Yeah. Well, it's still still at 9 o'clock there.
Can we get to substance here?
I just wanted to make a comment on the Detroit thing there. They bailed out GM, so they really need to bail that city out. And because Detroit's got a heart that won't quit. And so everything that they've been through, they've proven that. So it's time now to save the city and let people help them.
Well, how about
a lot of heart and a lot of history?
How about your namesake, though, Mike Ilitch? Why didn't he just write a check? You know, he'd say, "Here, a crisis over,
averted."
Yeah.
Well, after he bought the hockey team, the baseball team, and owns Little Caesars, we could figure out by now that it's never going to be about Detroit. That's about him, so we can forget that.
Well, what do you think? Do you think that the city and the state ought to be paying for his private entertainment district as much as it could possibly? And it's not even clear. Because remember, a lot of these studies show that these big stadiums and these big citizen-subsidized projects don't wind up putting much money either in the city's coffers or in the individual people's pocket, but wind up just being a big deficit, adding to it. We'll see.
Yeah, that's why Detroit's in the shape they're in, because that's what happens.
Hey, Mike, what city are you living in California?
We're Pasadena. We're going to move to Santa Barbara for the summer. We're not coming back. We had enough of that place.
Come visit once in a while now. Don't be a stranger.
Pasadena. I was
we got six kids there. We'll be back to see the kids. William, Paul, James, Michael, Charlene, and little Jonathan David. God bless you guys.
Wow.
I know you guys are,
childless?
Atheists.
Oh, yeah.
We're childless atheists.
Yeah. Pasadena, though, you go to the end of the street, right? Big one of those roads that goes through Pasadena, and wow, you're right up in the mountains, right?
Right, yeah. Right here.
Yeah, I did it. I was out there last January. All right,
Beautiful.
Mike, always a Detroiter. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You know what? Line one's been holding the longest. He called back.
Okay.
He called earlier.
All right. Okay, let's do it. Here is David in Detroit. David, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good. Thank you.
Good. I wanted to comment and tell you I couldn't agree with you more on this whole stadium thing. And it actually sounded for a minute in the beginning of the show like you were actually criticizing Keynesianism just a little bit. And I was kind of refreshed to hear that. But I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that unless we really have a serious conversation about getting things going where we're actually producing something again, you can forget it. All this service industry's crap. I mean, it's not going to do it. You cannot have an economy based on service jobs alone. So That being said, I wanted to bring up something to just bring to your attention, get your thoughts on it.
Wait a minute. Let me back up on one thing. Here is my opinion.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I will just say it, and I actually don't know if I want to argue about it. I don't think capitalism can exist on any other basis. You misread me. On any other basis than Keynesian economics, which is massive government infusion of cash through projects. And I mean, I don't know if it works. I don't know if capitalism is going to work in the long run, because the idea that it always has to be, that it's dynamic, that it always has to be growing, always have to be expanding. And it seems like it has to be since 1942, when the economy got out of the recession, only, or the depression of the 30s, only because of massive government spending on war expenditures, and which in many ways is still the basis of our economy, which is war Keynesianism. I don't know if it'll work any other way.
Yeah, but you're going under the assumption that it was something other than government that caused it. I would argue government caused it. So, but if that's neither here nor there. The point is that I think we could look at something. I was doing some research on the pension funds and how those things were really misinvested, mismanaged, the whole nine yards. And I don't think that the local news has done it any justice based on what I've seen. But in the research, I stumbled upon what Philadelphia is doing. And see what you think of this.
I know where you're going, but go ahead. This is a good idea.
Yeah, and it was a 12-minute video that I stumbled on called No More Detroit's, the Philadelphia Public Bank Project. And what it really boiled down to was they're in a similar situation that we are. They took the remaining amount of funds that they had, liquid assets that they had, used it as seed money, and opened up a public municipal bank by which the other members or the other banks in the city could, you know, you could borrow from, you could loan out to startup businesses, extremely low interest. And what they were doing was they were keeping investment in the city. They were keeping the funds in the city and not exposed to the Wall Street banksters.
Right.
So that when you have the downturns of Wall Street, you're not exposed to it. And it's similar, in theory, to what's going on with the North Dakota Bank. And we've seen, you know, right, the success they've had. So I wanted to get your thoughts on it as a means of stirring up some investment in the city and to get the city liquid again.
Well, I don't know, you know, overall, I mean, what sort of impact it would have, but it's a good idea. It's better, obviously, than what's occurred, and we've seen the results of what's occurred. And, yeah, that video, which I've seen, is online. And if people are saying, North Dakota Bank, what's the guy talking about? Just Google that, North Dakota Bank. Thank you, David, for bringing that up. Appreciate it. And we can talk about Keynesian economics some other time. All right. Let's go out to Jackson and talk to another Mike. It's all Mikes tonight. Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
I'd like to tell the other Mike that they have a great American name.
There you go.
Okay, Peter. Last week we talked about presidents, which I really enjoyed, but I'm kind of confused because George W. Bush's presidency didn't make any sense to me. George W. Bush's presidency made about as much sense to me as his oil career. Personally, I thought George W. Bush was emulating Reagan. My question for you, Peter, is do you think George W. Bush's presidency was President Reagan's third term?
Well, sure. I mean, it was the culmination. It was the culmination of Reaganomics, of the free market, of taking off regulations, of putting the interests of corporations first. So, look at George W. Bush. I mean, he almost looks benign now compared to. If your memory's not good, I mean, he's just sort of, suddenly he's gotten old. He just seems like this ditherer. And I don't think he was ever in charge. I mean, essentially, Cheney was running the president.
Karl Rove.
Yeah, Karl Rove and all that. What do they call him? Bush's brain. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he really was. Something happened to Bush along the way. When he was governor of Texas, he was very articulate and could
I think you're stretching it.
I saw a video. I don't know if you could Google this, but when he was running for governor, they asked him what was his policy on education. And he said, number one, number two, number three. I mean, he was like ticking it off. And then they showed one of these presidents, and he's going,
I mean, couldn't, I don't know what happened.
Couldn't even
either.
Get any words out. But anyway, it doesn't particularly matter whether he was articulate or even that he was particularly bright, but it was what kind of economic policies. And I mean, what's happened is that we are still into, in a sense, Ronald Reagan's and Reaganomics fifth or sixth or seventh term, because we've never completely broken with that for a number of reasons. I think a lot of people in the Democratic Party would like to put that all behind us and realize how destructive it's been to the economy. But certainly the Republicans want to conserve, as they are conservatives, want to conserve what is. And what is the banksters are still reigning supreme. And so now they like ruin the lives of tens of thousands of people with their subprime mortgages. So what are the banks doing now? They're just buying up all of the foreclosures, and by the thousands, literally buying.
They've got a whole new scam going
on.
Yeah,
now they're going to be renters. They're not going to be renters. They're going to be landlords to thousands of people. And this is where tens of millions of dollars are now going into investments, which actually might be a sounder investment for them as opposed to what occurred. But if you think most of them landed on their feet, and we say that we're really taking these banksters to task, we're fining them $2 billion. In the case of some of them, I think it was even like $13 billion. But, of course, the people that were responsible for sinking the American economy and for millions of people sinking their American dream, there's individuals who are getting off scot-free. All right, well, thank you very much, Mike. Appreciate that. You know, Mike brought up it. We've had this screen here that tells us what the caller's going to talk about. Mm-hmm. And it said the presidency. And I was thinking, you know, the Republican and these frothing right-wingers are already going nuts on Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
She's the, what do they call it, the presumptive
candidate.
The candidate.
It's going to get ugly.
Yeah, these Republicans are so stupid. They just don't get it. Even when, you know, they're going to be sure they don't pass any immigration reform, which they, you know, and some of the people, the leadership of the party says, look, you know, we got to start throwing at least some bones to people that are voting against the 60% and 70%. So what they're going with Hillary, they're going, the newest thing is their bitch strategy. You know, she's a bitch, you know, and they got all these.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and I was looking at these right
wing. And they're misogynists, okay?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, well, that they're just showing, you know, Chris Christie, for instance, who someone emailed us and said he was a thug. He's appealing to a lot of people because he is this.
He's Mr. Macho, right?
Mr. Macho, overbearing, doesn't take any crap from no one.
Yeah.
But when a woman expresses anything like that, it's
essentially. Oh, yeah, then we're a bitch.
Yeah, they're a bitch.
So, I know.
So
you
what,
call me that. I don't care.
So what is this going to do to the women that are seeing they're being critical of Hillary Clinton because they say she doesn't tolerate any. I don't know. I can't even remember. But in other words.
Crap.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? Maybe she's not a very nice person or that she...
I don't know. I met her. I thought she was quite lovely.
I was at, yeah, I was kind of, I went to a, were you at that? Were you? No, that was me and my wife. Were you there though? We were at a UAW conference in Washington when she spoke?
No.
Yeah.
I wasn't there.
Okay. And yeah, I mean, she seems nice, but you know,
all politicians seem nice.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, only in America do we care who our politicians are sleeping with, or whether they're mean or not mean, or what have you. I mean, that's nuts. Let's.
I want to hear what Maurice has to say.
Okay.
See what that topic says.
Yeah, Maurice wants to talk about Jalene. Hey, Maurice, welcome to the broadcast. Hey, Maurice.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello, sexy.
Are you talking to me? Are you talking to me?
Stand down, Peter.
Stand down, Peter.
Hey, Julie.
Yes, Maurice.
Hey, Shannon Bygoff. He ain't talking. Do you remember the first time you did a whiplash bash out at Up and Up?
I did the whiplash bash?
Yes.
I do. It goes way back.
I forgot what that is. What's the whiplash bash?
That was.
Shut up, Peter!
You better be careful.
Yeah, I am. I am.
No, with.
Peter, how big are you?
How big? How what? How big am
I? How big are you?
Big?
Yeah.
Peter, be quiet. What do you mean big?
Are you mean tall or big?
Oh, my God.
So anyway, Maurice, what about it?
Maurice, what have you been doing tonight?
Peter, Maurice and I are talking. Did
Peter,
you?
Stand Peter, down. Peter.
Stand down.
Stand down. I know you're right. You're the Ted Nugent. You're the Ted Nugent World of Bash.
I was.
You were. You remember you wore a black mini?
I wore a what?
You wore a black mini.
A black mini skirt?
Yeah. Like,
yeah. Man, that's possible.
Yes, ma'am.
So you have seen Jalene.
Give her Motorhead.
You know, Maurice, I'm cutting you loose.
No, he said Motorhead.
Yeah, I'm cutting you loose. All right, you have a good evening. Thanks for
Maurice,
joining
thanks
us.
For remembering my little black mini.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
Sounds like he's having a good time tonight. I hope he's not driving. He's a
Maurice,
cab driver.
No, he's not driving the cab anymore, remember?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's good. I mean, at least in that state. All right, here's Colin in Belleville. Colin, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Colin. Hello.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, my name's Tom. Sorry.
Oh, Tom. Hi, Tom.
But anyway,
I'm wearing jeans and a sweatshirt tonight.
Yeah.
Okay. I think the neighborhoods have really been subsidizing downtown Detroit for 47 years. You know, everything's been downtown since the 67 riot. You know, the taxes are ridiculous. I've got a house near Rouge Park and, the taxes are topping $2,000, you know, and we're seeing nothing out there, you know, in the neighborhoods. You
mean,
none of this,
yeah.
None of this stuff downtown translates to Warren and Evergreen or, you know, 6 Mile and Greenfield. Or, you know, people just aren't getting anything. You know, it's just bare bones. You know.
What do you think about Duggan? Says he's going to the mayor, the Detroit's mayor.
Well,
he says he's going to reduce taxes.
Great. Yeah, that'll be great. You know, I mean, that's a start. But, you know, downtown is just inverted socialism. You know, it's been that way forever, you know.
Well, you know, you're right. With, what was that called? After the riots in 67, there was this, I can't remember the name of it, but it was set up to reinvigorate Detroit. And you're absolutely right. The idea was, and it hasn't worked, and it's not going to work with this public subsidized stadium and entertainment district that Illich is putting together either, that it's sort of like if the downtown was the heart, then the body would be nourished as well. But you're right. It hasn't happened. I mean, I go down some of these streets. Jalene was concerned, rightly so, about having no lights on the freeway. You go down some of these residential streets and secondary streets, it is truly scary.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
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 Yeah. Well, I forgot what else I was going to say there. But, yeah, the
Me
neighborhood...
Me too, but I've got a way. I can always regroup for a while, yeah.
I don't know. Peter can go on
for
hours.
The other day, the Free Press had the headline was, you know, the project was going to transform Detroit. You know, and when people start buying homes and renovating homes in the neighborhood, that's the transformation of Detroit.
True. Yeah.
You know, you know, downtown's had enough. I kind of call downtown Quickenville. You know, Gilbert's done some
Quickenville. I love
down
that
there, but it's been easy pickings for him. You know.
Sure.
Okay, Peter.
All right. Thank you very much, Colin. Appreciate or Tom, I guess it was. It said
yeah,
Colin
Tom.
Here. Yeah, but
I can see how sometimes it's easy to get the wrong name. You know.
Yeah. Right. But if you're listening from afar, the reason that Tom was calling it Quickenville was because Dan Gilbert, the billionaire owner of who seems to have a good heart and
yes,
is concerned
does.
About Detroit and has put in an amazing amount of investment in there. He owns Quicken Loans, so that's why he was called Quickenville.
But I thought that was interesting, inverted socialism. I've never heard anyone say that on this show before.
I was kind of sorting through the inverted socialism. What we're having... is socialism for the rich.
That's what
he meant?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
I think so.
All right, okay.
Because I was trying to figure it out myself. That's interesting.
This is pretty good. CVS Caremark, the country's largest drugstore chain in overall sales, announced that it's going to stop selling cigarettes and other tobacco products by October.
Yeah, I saw that. And then I saw a bunch of different kind of commentary on it in that, oh, this is a place that is meant to heal people. You get your pharmaceuticals yeah. there. You get your health and health and beauty aids there, but also they sell a whole bunch of sugar and yeah. a whole bunch of junk food and things that aren't necessarily good. So I don't even really buy all that argument. But I think it is a step in a direction.
Sure, it's good. Kathleen Sebelius, who is the Secretary of Health and Human Services for the U.S. government, said that the CVS decision was, quote, an unprecedented step in the retail industry, and said it would have considerable impact. Well, yeah, the CVS executives met with executives from the tobacco companies to discuss the shift, and the CEO of CVS said he would expect they would be disappointed with this decision.
You know what I also thought, because we're always a little skeptical sometimes when anything in corporate America occurs, is that maybe they weren't selling that many cigarettes.
Well, it said, I forget, where was this figure? They were going to lose something, $2 billion a year. But their overall sales are $123 billion.
Yeah.
So
and they're behind Walgreens. It's Walgreens and then CVS. That's kind of how that hierarchy goes. So we'll see what kind of effect that has on the rest of these types of stores.
You know, I don't know why I thought about this, but you know, there were
because they have, you know, the tobacco stores now that are up and down 9 Mile, just
sure.
not far from here. There's stores where you could just go get tobacco.
I don't know why of all the products I thought of this, but you know, for a while there were these crib deaths because these little babies, so tragic, put their head between
the railings
and died because of that.
Yeah.
And the massive concern. I mean, I was trying to think about how many kids died. I mean, I would be surprised.
I can't even barely think about it.
But I would be surprised if it was 100, wouldn't you? I mean, someone said it was like 40 or something
right.
like that.
I don't know.
According to Secretary Sebelius, that each day some 3,200 children under 18 will try a cigarette and 700 will go on to become daily smokers. That means, she said, that 5.6 million American children alive today will die premature deaths because of diseases linked to smoking.
I wish they'd make a healthy cigarette. 'Cause I'm not going to lie. Once in a while, I enjoy a little tobacco.
What do you think about vaping?
Oh, vaporizers? Or you mean e-cigarettes?
Yeah, they call. Hey, I'm trying.
I'm not convinced there's anything good about that either.
It's a nicotine delivery system. So you get what people want out of nicotine. And
for me, it's the ritual, you know? Like, when I do go out of my house and I go somewhere and my friends are smoking, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to have one. Give me one of those. Not all the time, Peter. I didn't get these golden pipes without a couple cigarettes.
But
it's a ritual. I mean, it's an ancient ritual. Think about it. Peace pipes. It goes way, 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 way back.
But not 20 a day.
No. Yeah. No.
I may have told you. Seems like we...
And you used to smoke a long time ago yourself.
Yeah, except my girlfriend...
Be up front.
My girlfriend wouldn't kiss me.
Oh, jeez. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
She meant that much to you that you did marry her. So.
Well, it wasn't the kissing, exactly.
Oh, God. La, 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 la.
Yeah, okay. But remember there was, I don't remember where it was. There was a little slogan, I'm sorry, folks, if you fall into this category. Kissing a smoker is like licking an ashtray.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of gross.
That's why they have Altoids. It's all right.
Yeah. But let me see, cigarettes, what was I thinking of? I wonder whether I was saying that when you remember the caller that said he lost his train of thought? And I said, yeah, after a while, when you're in the biz, you can figure out.
Are you not recovering?
No, I didn't recover. cigarette. But it's kind of odd. I mean, people make this comparison all the time about, The reason that marijuana, for instance, is illegal is because the government is trying to protect our health, right? That's why all these people are criminal. That's why.
The government.
Yeah, millions and millions of people have become criminals, had their lives ruined, have created this enormous...
Because of drug laws.
Yeah, because of drug laws, because they're trying to protect our health. Well, for one thing...
They don't want people to get high.
But, you know, this is so standard, yet it doesn't resonate probably in the way that it should. So you have here 5.6 million people, about 400,000 people a year, die from cigarette-related diseases. Zero people die from marijuana smoking, right?
Right.
And probably the people that die from heroin overdose, which we know people do because of the recent death of that movie star.
Oh, yeah.
With three names.
Right.
Yeah. And we'll think of it, folks. Don't even bother to tell
We know
us.
Who
yeah.
it is.
It's coming to me quickly. We need the room. Remember? he kept saying that in Charlie Wilson's War. Can we have the room, please?
Oh, yeah.
You know, yeah. All right. Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was thinking Philip Michael Thomas. Wasn't that the guy that was in with Don Johnson, Miami Vice?
Could be.
And but, no respect to Philip Seymour Hoffman. I adored him.
Yeah. So, and then there's been all this terrible heroin around that's killed like 22 people in Pittsburgh and all that.
Because it has fentanyl to it.
But I'll bet,
not that you can't die from a heroin overdose without fentanyl.
Well, we can look this up, but I'll bet you that if 2,000 people a year die from heroin overdoses, I would be surprised, maybe. I mean, the big one is pharmaceuticals that people are dying a lot from. But so here we have...
From overdosing?
Yeah. Here we have 400,000 people dying from cigarettes, which is legal and even kind of hip in some circles.
It's always the legal stuff that's the worst.
Yeah.
Really?
Well,
booze, I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah. Why?
Booze and pills and cigs.
It could have been the other way around. I mean, in other words, depending who were the corporate interests. In other words, if there were... You know, heroin and cocaine and marijuana corporations, and they would have made cigarettes and booze illegal. Oh, that's right. Booze was illegal.
Yeah. That little thing called prohibition.
Yeah. Well, okay, Jefferson, if I would have looked at the screen, he had it up there. He was I didn't see it.
What?
I thought of it. He had it up there, Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Thank you, Jefferson.
All right,
Jefferson. Who, by the way, is taking your phone calls. And we have one more segment left in the show for this week anyway. So if you want to get in on any of these subjects, and as usual, we're all over the place, but we haven't said it lately. If you have something you want to bring up, please do.
Sure. And maybe you could do this while you're waiting for calls. Jefferson, look up how many heroin deaths a year, are there?
In the U.S.?
In the U.S., yeah.
Okay.
I doubt if it's...
If I had a working computer, I'd do it.
That's right. Hey, and one of these things, the subjects that we talked about, and Jalene and I think it's so peculiar, about the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
Because it's this big debatable thing. I mean, the Republicans are still just frothing about it, even though it's working better and better, and millions of people are now enrolled in it.
But the radar on it it's fallen off the radar, hasn't it?
It's fallen off the WRIF night call show radar, that's for sure. We have asked, had anybody, right when that disastrous rollout occurred,
the website,
had anybody tried it and had bad experiences? Nobody called. And then we said, has anybody used it and...
I haven't really talked to anyone who's done it.
I don't know. Have you? No.
It's the big mystery.
But one of the things that happened, and I want to talk about this when we come back, the Congressional Budget Office, which is nonpartisan, and here are the Republicans who still want to repeal it, who still want to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
How could you want to repeal something called the Affordable Care Act? I mean,
If you're them, quite easily.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would say, as we said, that every problem with it would be solved if we had Medicare for all. And we've got the money. So it's no problem. But all of this is pretty crazy. But one of the things they're on about now, the Republicans are on about, is that it's this job killer. We'll talk about that when we come back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call.
Did you know that millions of seniors are treated each year for fall-related injuries? If you or someone you love is elderly and living alone, get ready for a toll-free number that could save a life. LifeStation is a medical alert system that provides the security and peace of mind to live a fulfilling and independent life in the comfort of your own home. Call LifeStation now at 1-855-322-5013. For less than a dollar a day, LifeStation offers quick access to medical help at just the touch of a button, 24 hours a day. Day, 7 days a week. And with LifeStation, there's no setup fee and no long-term contracts. You can cancel at any time. Call right now for more information at no obligation. 1-855-322-5013. Put emergency help at your fingertips while maintaining your independence. Call LifeStation at 1-855-322-5013. The call and information are free. 1-855-322-5013. That's 1-855-322-5013.
This is your Travel Minute. If you're planning a flight for business or pleasure anytime soon, here's the 3-1-1 rule for carry-on luggage to ease your way through airport security lines. Rule 1. Only 3-ounce or smaller containers of liquid or gel are permitted in carry-on luggage. However, larger containers are permitted in your check-in baggage. 2. Place your 3-ounce or smaller containers into one 1-quart size clear plastic zip-top bag. Only one bag per traveler is allowed. 3. Place the bag into the security bin with your shoes and other items as required for scanning. The rules for other personal items vary, so it's a good idea to check with your airline or travel agent before you pack for your trip.
Your Travel Minute is a public service by this station and ASTA, the American Society of Travel Agents.
Confessions of a Potentially Perfect Parent, brought to you by AdoptUsKids.org.
I might look like an adult, like a person who could possibly be a parent, but I have no idea how to talk like one. And everyone knows that if you want to be a parent, you have to sound good when you say things like, "Don't make me turn this car around," or "Because I said so," or "Don't make me come back there." I don't even really know what those things mean, but I know that I actually believed my parents when they said them to me. How did they manage to sound so convincing? Here we go. "Don't make me come back there." Ugh, no, that's not tough enough at all. Kids can sense weakness. "Don't make me come back there." Ooh, yeah, that's better. In fact, that kind of sounded like my dad. Weird.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who would love to listen to you practice your dad voice. Call 1-888-200-4005 or visit AdoptUsKids.org for more information. This message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
In 1977 in Johannesburg, South Africa, an 8-year-old boy picked up the game of golf from his father. By the age of 9, he was already outplaying him. The odds of that same boy then making it to the US and European pro golf tours? 1 in 7 million. The odds of the Big Easy winning the Open Championship once and the US Open Championship twice? 1 in 780 million. The odds of this professional golfer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 150. Ernie Else encourages you to learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much. Give us a call. We got one segment left, and you can get your voice on the air. 248-544-WRIF.
248-544-9743. Got a couple few calls coming in, so we'll round out the show with that.
Yeah, I want to urge you to go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, or our Facebook page, Facebook.com/Night Call, because February 11th, which is, let me see, 9th, 10th, 11th, it's Tuesday, it's called The Day We Fight Back Against Mass Surveillance. And there is, let me see if I can remember the name of this group, the Electronic Frontier people. And it says, together we're going to push back against the powers that seek to observe, collect, and analyze our every digital action. Together we will make it clear that such behavior is not compatible with democratic governance. Together we will persist. We will win this fight. So you can hook on to this, or you can just go directly to thedaywefightback.org, thedaywefightback.org. And let's see, also on my site and on Facebook, a list of our guests, Alfred Meyer coming up pretty soon, talking about Fermi 3. Whoa, where's that?
Scary.
Yeah, that's what the DTE wants to build, this Fermi 2, which is, I mean, talk about paying and subsidizing big corporations. These big, there wouldn't be nuclear power without the government. You can't possibly be a libertarian, for instance, and support nuclear power because no one, there's no insurance company that will be willing to write policies for any nuclear plant, fearful that they might have to pay out like $400 billion of every.
Heard of Fukushima?
Exactly, exactly. Also, Steve Early, who I've had on a number of times, Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. And he's talking about the demise of unions and how this affects negatively the wages and benefits of everybody that works.
Yeah, and yeah. On the heels of that, there's in Tennessee a lot going on with, it's Volkswagen actually right now.
Sure.
Trying to, they may or may not unionize. You think it's going to happen?
Well, VW, which has had incredibly positive experiences with the German auto unions, is not combating the UAW's attempt to unionize their plant. And on the other hand, you got all these right-wingers coming in from all over the country saying, oh, it's going to wind up like Detroit, like somehow the UAW was responsible for what's
right.
happened to Detroit.
That's what they say, and they have billboards up
yeah.
all over down there saying, do you want to end up like Detroit? Do what the UAW did to Detroit.
Yeah. I mean, what the UAW did to Detroit and what the whole union movement did was to provide a middle class. I mean, because what essentially these conservatives want to do is they want to send us all back to the 19th century.
Le Dark Ages.
Now, Jefferson found out that there were 4,251 heroin deaths, overdoses last year. That's considerable. But that is what? 1%. 1% of how many people die from cigarettes.
Right. Yeah.
So we're going crazy.
And ciggies are more tough to beat than heroin from what I hear.
Yeah, yeah. I have a feeling I know what this call is going to be about. Here's Paul from Sterling Heights. Paul, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Pete. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Paul.
Let me start this out with the right-wing hate talk radio lie that all Democrats are liberals.
Right.
Do we agree that it's not so?
I agree, but I would think some people would probably be mystified by it.
Well, look, it's the lie that Newt Gingrich started in the Contract Against America.
That, I like how he calls it that. Yeah, that's good.
Contract on America. Yeah.
Now, we have a senator, a Democratic senator named Debbie Stabenow, when she was first elected, she voted for a law that expanded the credit card's rights to charge extra interest. And she just voted for the farm bill that's going to cut off food subsidy programs.
Right.
Well, she did more than just vote for it. She was one of the co-sponsors of it.
Yeah, but
one of the main framers of it, yeah.
But, look, I told you the last time we spoke, my bumper sticker is, visit Michigan for a taste of dictator.
Yeah.
I know I can't trust Governor Rick Snyder. That's plain, you know, come on.
Let alone it's hard to hear him talk. I can't even stand to hear his voice.
Yeah, but look.
Not to be petty or anything.
A conservative is a conservative. I don't care what party they are. And Debbie Stabenow is not anything but a conservative.
Now, you know what? Here, I mean, this is not a defense of her at all, because I think if the Democrats were in any way compatible with what their conception of them is, that they would fight tooth and nail for every one of those things. So the Republicans wanted to cut, what was it, like $40 billion from food stamps. So it would have just immiserated the lives of millions and millions of people, particularly children. So she thinks that the fact that she compromised and they're only cutting $8 billion from poor people's sustenance, actually, that probably was a good compromise. And government is about compromise, after all. Well, yeah, unless it's based on your principles. And if these rotten conservatives want to starve poor people, and because the reason they want to starve poor, I don't know that they're each individually, you know, evil people, and they're thinking, ha, 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 these people are going to starve. But what it does, it feeds their official propaganda that the reason that people aren't working is because they have an incentive not to work because they can get food stamps. Well, what a, as you were saying earlier, Jalene, what a luxurious life.
Oh, it's just so.
Oh, my God.
They are just la da 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 da.
You can get all the spam you want and,
canned goods.
Yeah.
You know, anything. Fast food. You can try to get some fast food.
I don't know, with food stamps.
You can't?
No.
No, some restaurants do take them.
Really? Bridge cards?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Well, anyway, the whole idea, though, that is kind of ingrained in our system, and we haven't had anybody also talk about people call and talk about being a recipient of food stamps. It's got to be a little bit of a humiliation.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, you pull out your credit card or your wallet, and you pay for your groceries, the person behind you, because of circumstances, not of their making, but of the banksters, of the people that...
Of what the life that they were born into and will never get out of due to the way it is, the way the system is built.
One of the reasons, the first people to put in social services that were paid for by the government were conservative governments in Europe, and including health programs, I think going back even into the 1880s. And the reason that they did... is they wanted to head off any liberal change or any revolution. So, I mean, one of the things you could do would just be cut all the poor people off of everything. I mean, I'm not advocating this. And you'd have a revolution in about, 10 days. Because people would be literally fighting for
dying
survival.
In the street.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here's Ron in Shelby Township. Ron, hi, you're on the air.
Peter, Julie, how you been?
Man. Yeah, good.
I just want to make a comment, Peter, about the Affordable Care Act, okay?
Yeah.
The bottom line is, we need to clear this up once and for all. The Affordable Care Act is a scam and it's fraudulent, and you ought to get Chris Ann Hall on your show, period.
Well, tell me, I'm not going to do that, but why should I have her on the air when I can have
Chris, you? But
I can have you on for half the price.
Oh, you know who Chris Ann Hall is?
No.
For free.
No.
No, Chris Ann Hall would come on your show. She is probably this country's foremost leading constitutional lawyer.
Uh-huh.
You ought to get in contact with Chris Ann Hall. I've listened to her many times on Joyce Riley.
Okay, I'm not going to do that. So tell me, why...
would you want me to set you up with her?
No, I want you to tell me.
I'm his producer. I'll take care of that.
Yeah.
I'd get a hold of Chris Ann Hall.
Okay, well, thanks for the suggestion. I'll write it down.
And, you know, the echo.
Just too much. Yeah. What is up with your phone, Ron?
We're going to have to, I wanted to hear more from you, Ron, but there's something going on when we talk to you. There is this echo that is,
I think it's the feds.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the NSA.
Right. Yeah, there is tremendous problems with, the Affordable Care Act. I mean, it's done some really good things, and it's brought health care and will bring even to millions. It will bring even to more millions.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, part of it is that it extends Medicaid. Where is this? I was looking for something. Oh, yeah. This is the Medicaid expansion allows states to opt out of it, even though the federal government would pay for every single dime that of the new Medicaid patients in.
So, for example, the South,
Yeah, the South. The number, this is according to the Harvard Medical School and the City University of New York. The number of deaths attributable to the lack of Medicaid expansion in opt-out states. In other words, these are Republican-controlled states, conservative-controlled states, right-wing-controlled states. They're going to say, we're not going to allow Medicaid expansion, which means that poor people cannot enroll in it. That they think that there will be, the number of deaths attributable to this will be between 7,000 and 17,000. Medicaid expansion in opt-out states would have resulted in 712,000 fewer people screening positive for depression. I don't know why that's at the top, but I mean,
I don't know why either.
240,000 people suffering catastrophic medical expenditures. Medicaid expansion in those states would have resulted in 422,000 more diabetics receiving medication for their illnesses. 200,000 more mammograms among women, 443,000 more pap smears, and on and on and on and on like that. The researchers found that because of the 25 states opting out of Medicaid expansion, 7.78 million people who would have gained coverage will remain uninsured.
I mean, and I know numbers are hard for people to wrap their brains around, but if you really stop and think about, that's almost 8 million people. 8 million people. But you know what?
They don't care.
They don't care.
You know what? Can I say SOB out? Is that okay on the air?
I'd just say SOB.
Yeah, I want to say the whole thing. I think Mike Malloy else.
I don't think he should.
Okay. These heartless SOBs. About that. These
aren't people. These aren't faces. These aren't real human beings to these folks. Okay, they're just over there.
Yeah,
they're kind of a menace to society in the minds of these haters. It's just disgusting.
Yep. One of the things that's come out this week was the Congressional Budget Office estimated on Tuesday that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, will reduce the number of full-time workers by 2.5 million over the next decade. And the New York Times says that is mostly a good thing, a liberating result of the law. You say, wait a minute.
Yeah.
And the Republicans immediately jumped out. It's a job killer. See, we said it was a job killer. Well, actually, it's the opposite. But they attempted to brand the findings of the Congressional Budget Office as devastating, stark evidence of President Obama's health care reform as a failure and a job killer. And the New York Times says, and I agree, it's no such thing. But before we go on, what would the Republicans do? They actually finally, because they were just Dr. No, they would have reversed all of these very, very popular features of Obamacare. The report estimated that thanks to an increase in insurance coverage under the act and the availability of subsidies to help pay the premiums, many workers who felt obliged to stay in a job that provided health benefits would now be able to leave those jobs or choose to work fewer hours than they otherwise would have. In other words, the report is about the choices that workers can make when they no longer are tethered to an employee because of health benefits.
So perhaps pursue a dream and do something they want to really do, something that will make them happier?
Well, also, there's a lot of sick people that have to stay in their jobs in order to get health care.
And elderly who can't really function. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they get Medicare, but they can still
in their job position. You know, maybe it's time for some of these people just to be able to go home.
And the old expression about figures don't lie, but liars can figure applies to these Republicans. They said the report, this Congressional Budget Office report, clearly states that the health reform would not produce an increase in unemployment or underemployment. It also found no compelling evidence that as of now, part-time employment... part-time employment has increased as a result of the reform law. Am I saying that right? It also found no compelling evidence, part-time employment has increased as a result of the reform law. That's odd that they say that, because a lot of these, I'll use the SOB phrase again, these employers, these wealthy employers, these chain, fast food places, they've said, okay, we're going to move you from full-time with no benefits, no health insurance at all.
You can work this many hours a week.
What is it, 23 hours in your part-time?
It's different. Different places have different standards.
Okay. So they're going to, I think there's some federal man, there's some federal mandated thing. So they're, what they're going to do, in order so they're chained.
I think you can work 34.
Okay.
Yeah.
But whatever it is that these owners have moved, it's, so it's not Obamacare, it's their greed. It's, I mean, how in the world are they working people in a modern era without proper health insurance?
Quite easily on their end.
Yeah. Did you shut up my mic off?
No, I don't have that ability.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things I was not going to talk about was the Beatles. This was the 50th anniversary of their appearance on the Ed Sullivan
yes,
Show.
Yes, yes.
And I thought everybody must be so over that. And
not look, at all.
Look who's on the cover of Rolling Stone.
The Beatles.
The Beatles.
Yeah, you know, we did a lot of tribute stuff around the building here this weekend, and I got a little bit weepy about it. I really did, because I did. I think, you know, just as a musician, Peter, I can't believe you wouldn't. What kind of music lover are you? The Beatles changed the United States. They changed rock and roll.
They did.
I mean, I know Elvis did his part, but they really changed it.
They did. They did. In fact, the headline is How the Beatles Took America, the Biggest Explosion in Rock and Roll History.
It was awesome. I mean, I was not even really here.
And did you play? Did you play Beatles music today?
I did.
What'd you play?
A lot of stuff.
Like?
Don't put me on the spot.
Yeah, I mean there is so many. We were talking about that. I like a lot of that George when he's playing the sitar. What is it? Tomorrow Never Knows or something like that. And Within You, Without You, and that kind of spacier stuff.
Of course you did.
Although, you know, I never used to, I was thinking, why
would
I?
The kind of more, I liked when Lennon grew his hair long, when Sean, that's when I, the music, when he had longer hair. You know, he was getting a little more about the revolution and things like that.
Yeah, he was down with the revo.
He was so cool.
Yeah. You want to say goodnight?
Good night.
Yeah. All right.
I do. It's been a long day, but I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Yeah, me too.
And especially you, Maurice.
Hey, Maurice, and everyone else, thank you for listening. Thank you for calling. Jefferson, as usual, thanks for
great
doing.
Job on the phone. Thank
thanks
you.
For doing the, well, it's not a thankless duty, because we thanked you.
Yes, we thank him every week.
All right, got some great interviews ahead. Again, I would urge you to go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Go to our Facebook page. There's terrific stuff. There's I mentioned earlier, there's the Pussy Riot video of the two leading members, publicly at least, although they've just been expelled, on the Stephen Colbert show.
I'm even going to thank you for encouraging me to watch that, Peter Werbe.
And a couple of great interviews coming up. So we'll do it again next week.
Thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Riff. We'll return with more Night Call right after this. Night Call. Night Call.
Valentine's Day is right around the corner. Pro Flowers has a special offer for one dozen long-stem assorted roses, plus an upgraded vase, plus free chocolates, all for just $29.99. Click the banner now or go to proflowers.com, click the blue microphone in the top right corner, and enter code RIBBON. Order today for guaranteed Valentine's Day delivery. That's proflowers.com, click the mic, and enter RIBBON for this exclusive deal.
License and registration.
But I'm walking.
Do you want to upset an officer of the law?
No, sir.
Good. I pulled you over today for littering.
I didn't litter.
Wow. That's what they all say. Unfortunately, I saw you drop a pair of thunder thighs a few blocks back. Probably happened as you were biting into that apple you're holding.
How did you know they're my thunder thighs?
Well, my young friend, I'd like to say 2 years in the police academy helped figure it out, but between us, it was smallstep.gov.
Smallstep.gov?
Yep, Rooney. It's this site with tons of easy ways to lose weight. Some steps are so easy, people don't realize they're doing them. Like you taking small step number 83, snack on fruits. Go to smallstep.gov, you'll see. You can drive off now.
I'm still walking.
Take a small step to get healthy at smallstep.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
This is your Car Care Minute. drivers are keeping their vehicles longer these days and will eventually need the services of a reliable auto repair shop. With that in mind, here's some tips on how to choose one wisely. Start shopping for a repair facility before you need one. Ask your friends and associates for their recommendations. Don't choose a shop based solely on location. Look for a neat, well-organized facility. The staff should be courteous, and the service technician or consultant should be willing to answer your questions. Look for evidence of certified technicians, such as the ASE sign. And when you do select your facility, reward good service with repeat business and customer loyalty. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
Exercise is hard. So is maintaining a healthy diet. Of course, neither is half as hard as dying. Sadly, Type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and stroke kill nearly a million people a year. Even sadder, most of these deaths are preventable with a few lifestyle changes, including regular activity, healthier eating, and not smoking. Talk to your doctor about your risk for type 2 diabetes and heart disease. And if your doctor recommends lifestyle changes or medication, listen. The reason so many die is because not enough are willing to change. You can stop it. Starting right now. It's your life. Listen to your doctor. Eat better. Get moving. Visit checkupamerica.org or call 1-800-DIABETES. A message from the American Diabetes Association.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The 2014 Riff Rock Girl Search is on. Ladies, get more details or apply online now at WRIF.com. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I can't count the number of times we've talked about nuclear power. Nuclear power is something that lurks on the shores of Lake Michigan, Lake Erie. I can't remember the exact number of power plants powered by nukes around the country. Great controversy always about them. Where are we going to put the waste? That's never been faced. But what we're facing here in Michigan is the proposal by DTE that we have yet another. This would be Fermi 3. You go, wait, these guys keep building them, don't they? Fermi 1, Fermi 2. Remember Fermi 1? We almost lost Detroit. Well, that didn't work so well. So we went on to Fermi 2. Now, as Pete Seeger used to say, we're knee-deep in the big muddy, and the big fool said, keep on. Joining me is Alfred Meyer. He is a member of the National Board of Directors of the Physicians for Social Responsibility. And the PSR is the U.S. affiliate of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. It was the winner of the 1985 Nobel Peace Prize. And Alfred Meyer is going to be touring our state between February 12th and February 17th, including stops in Ann Arbor and Ferndale, and some other ones as well. And his talk is going to be Nuclear Power, What You Need to Know About Price, Pollution, and Proliferation. And we reach Alfred Meyer somewhere in upstate New York right now. Usually he's headquartered where the PSR, the Physicians for Social Responsibility Office, is in Washington, D.C. Alfred Meyer, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you for having me on today, Peter.
You know, I gave a little thumbnail sketch of Physicians for Social Responsibility. Just maybe expand on that a little. And it's pretty interesting that a group of physicians for social responsibility could actually win a Nobel Peace Prize. How did that come about?
Well, it goes back to the historic founding of the organization in part, which was in the early 60s when there was a great deal of atmospheric nuclear testing going on. And PSR became alarmed about the health impacts of that and was able to develop the scientific information and convince President Kennedy to approve the atmospheric nuclear test ban. Then in the 80s, PSR was again very active politically as in an advocacy role with trying to get rid of nuclear weapons. And that was what we shared the new Nobel Peace Prize for. was the work between Reagan and Gorbachev and the efforts. We came very close, actually, to having an international agreement to ban nuclear weapons, which is something that is still of a great concern to the world today.
Mm-hmm. And am I correct? The group was founded by the great American physician whose name is right out of my brain, the woman who actually met with President Reagan to tell him what a danger nuclear weaponry was.
Well, the first founding of PSR in the 60s was by a group of distinguished doctors in Boston. It's Helen Caldicott.
Oh, yes.
Thinking of, and she is an Australian physician who is still to this day in her ongoing years a vibrant and very active advocate, warning about the dangers of radiation and what its health impacts are.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenges we struggle with to really get the a clear answer to many very important questions.
She is such a magnificent woman. I feel ashamed that I didn't remember her name. I do remember one of her stories, though, that she told me when I interviewed her about taking both of Reagan's hands and looking him in the eye and telling him, Mr. President, that nuclear weapons could destroy our entire world. And she said he actually looked frightened. And the other thing that was so interesting is she had a longer audience with the president alone than any other civilian had during his whole 8 years. Reagan's daughter, who was sympathetic to the cause of abolition of nuclear weapons, had arranged the meeting. But let's get on to what you're going to be doing here in the state of Michigan, Alfred Meyer. You're going to be talking about nuclear power, what you need to know about price, pollution, and proliferation. And there is an incredible campaign being waged by Beyond Nuclear, which you can go to beyondnuclear.org, and also Physicians for Social Responsibility, to make sure that Fermi 3 does not enter our world. Why does DTE, the power company here in Michigan, why does it want Fermi 3? They got Fermi 2. That's bad enough. What's going on here?
Well, it's from a business standpoint. If you're an owner of one of these things, it's a pretty good setup. You get the taxpayer, you and I, to cover the risk of building it. It's a huge, huge investment to build a new reactor, and they almost always go way over budget. So risky that no Wall Street, no smart money wants to invest in it. So the taxpayer, you and I, get the risk. But then the profit, of course, doesn't come to us who took the risk, but rather goes to the private owners. So it's an odd kind of nuclear socialism. And then it's rounded out with the government taking possession of the waste that's been created by this activity. This is waste that will last essentially forever and that we know not what to do with. But yet, in the meantime, for an operating reactor, you can make $1 million a day or so.
That's amazing. You know, I've talked about this subject for I don't know how many years, and yet the two arguments about the profits returning to the company itself, of course, we should have thought this was self-evident. This happens a number of different situations, including this new hockey arena here that's partly going to be built with public funds like they are around the country, but also that we take out the garbage for them, the nuclear waste, except we're not really doing it, are we? Because there isn't anywhere to put the nuclear waste.
We don't know what to do with the waste, and that's a huge, huge problem, and a good reason, we think, to argue don't make more. Stop making it until we figure out what the heck to do with what we've got. But furthermore, the U.S. taxpayer's on the hook for the insurance, because not only is it too risky to invest in a nuclear reactor to build, but to operate, no insurance company will cover it. So once again, the U.S. public has been drawn into the fray to cover a risk and a cost, but without any benefit. The nuclear industry pays what in essence is a deductible amount into a fund, but we, the general taxpayer, are on the hook for any cost if something like Fukushima were to happen. And Fermi 2, of course, is a twin of the Fukushima GE reactors. If something like that would happen in some American city, the cost would be astronomical.
You know, I love your phrase, nuclear socialism, but it occurred to me that that argument could almost be used against what I often say. That is, we have like a fire department socialism, we have police socialism, we have public school teacher socialism. In other words, a cost of something that we need is socialized in the sense that we, you know, we couldn't get a neighborhood to build a school and to pay teachers or our local police. And in the same way, if we want energy, we certainly couldn't get the billions and billions needed to provide a nuclear plant. But what we get out of it is we get power. We can power everything that we need for the modern world.
You know, well, that's an arguable question.
Okay.
And we also get much more than power. I mean, this, let's remember that this entire activity, the entire nuclear fuel chain from mining uranium, which is terribly polluting and very damaging to people's health and leaves great environmental problems behind, and mining tailings, through the refinement, enrichment, processing, all these activities of the fuel chain are very damaging to the environment and to our health. But it's all this is happening to boil water.
Tell people what that means, because people usually think nuclear power directly goes into our light bulbs.
No, it's a thermal form of electricity generation, and it came out of the atomic bomb effort. Nuclear reactors were conceived of, designed, built, and operated first and foremost to make the materials for the plutonium atomic bombs. So it is, and to this day, there remains a close connection between the nuclear power industry and its infrastructure and its training programs and universities and the skills and capabilities needed for nuclear weapons, which we're still making in this country. So that was all done in secrecy in the Manhattan Project. But somebody did realize that, my gosh, we're dumping quite a bit of hot water out back. We could run a steam turbine and generate electricity. So that's what a nuclear reactor does. It boils water, because when you start a chain reaction, the nuclear chain reaction, it creates intense heat. It's like almost like a little bit of the sun right here on Earth. So we have to cool it with a billion, that's a B with a boy, billion gallons of water a day. And we take in cold water and put out the heated water. But that's in essence what a nuclear reactor does, spins that generator, but then leaves behind this highly radioactive waste. After you've used a fuel rod in a reactor, it's not worn out and empty like a gas tank is in your car, but rather it's changed into intensely radioactive and intensely heat, hot elements, so which have to be stewarded, taken care of for into eternity. Some of these elements remain radioactive for millions of years.
My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Alfred Meyer. He's a member of the National Board of Directors of the Physicians for Social Responsibility. And Alfred Meyer is going to be in our state between the 12th and 17th of February, speaking about nuclear power, what you need to know about price, pollution, and proliferation. And he's going to be in Grand Rapids and Kalamazoo and South Haven and closer to home here, Ferndale, Monroe in Ann Arbor. And the schedule, I assume, is on beyondnuclear.org and perhaps as well on the physician's website, psr.org. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E. Now, I was just reading the New York Times today, and they say that the staff of the government that regulates and such things within the Environmental Protection Agency are going to create these pollution rules that may wind up to close as many as 100 coal-burning plants, which, of course, are absolutely disastrous to the environment. And this has led a number of environmentalists, including some prominent ones, to say, look, it's a devil's bargain, but nuclear power is better than coal. And so I think you are very much aware of this sudden turn of these environmentalists to say that we need nuclear power. I mean, that's traitorous almost. I would say it is. But what they make an argument that says we got to power modern society. We get rid of the coal. We don't have anything else. We can't get alternatives in place soon enough. And perhaps, and some of them say there you can't get enough power out of alternative energy to power the huge apparatus of modern industrial consumer capitalism.
Well, there's no question whatsoever that coal burning needs to stop as soon as possible. It's a terrible activity. It's damaging to human health through the mercury pollution. It's damaging to the atmosphere through CO2 emissions. No question at all, we need to stop it. However, nuclear is not the answer. I can refer your listeners to two different books that are both are one is available for free download, and the other, the summary, is available free, IEER.org, the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, IEER.org. Dr. Arjun Makajani's book, Carbon Free, Nuclear Free, A Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy, was published in 2007. It assumes the existing American lifestyle, which, by the way, per capita, we consume twice as much energy as Europeans do. That this book solves this problem without saying we have to cut back. It says go ahead and use the American serving size of energy. It also assumes existing 2007 technology. And this book lays out a very detailed plan for how we can move away from carbon-based fuels and shut down nuclear power plants within 40 years. And Dr. Makajani, now, but 6 years after publishing the book, says that this could be achieved even faster. And there are a number of other studies around the country. There's one from Mark Jacobson at Stanford University, is working on state-by-state plans to show in particular how this can be done. The other book I would mention is called Insurmountable Risks by Bryce Smith. And this is a book which says, okay, if let's assume we're going to use nuclear reactors to solve climate change. What would that look like? And we would be having to open, you know, build thousands of reactors. We can barely build one or two new ones in the entire world. We'd have to be building thousands. It's just an insurmountable challenge. We don't have industrial capacity. Even if there weren't, and even if we overlooked the other significant flaws and dangers and costs of nuclear energy.
You know, Alfred Meyer, I was going to say, you present it, and well that you should, as a technical problem. We have something that's not working well. There are alternatives. The one that's not working well is doing great damage to our health and the health of the planet. And here is a roadmap how we could technically not even improve this, but solve this problem. Yet what stands in the way of this, of course, is politics and profits. So we have these poisonous industries, the oil industry, the coal industry, even the natural gas industry, and particularly now how they're getting their supplies through fracking. And we're up against guys like the Koch brothers who invest millions and millions and millions of dollars funding so-called science that denies climate change. They get representatives and senators elected. They'd like to get a president elected that would keep things as they are. They want to conserve. That's why they're conservative. They want to conserve things as they are, which benefits them. Yet you would think these guys with their money, they could just whip off enough out of their pocketbooks to fund all this. But so there's both this. I'll put another P in there, and that would be psychology. The inertia against change, I guess, is always a problem.
Well, it's my personal opinion that part of nuclear power is a cover story for nuclear weapons. And that our security plan in this country still centers on nuclear weapons. That's why other countries like Iran want them. And this link between nuclear power and nuclear weapons is clearly displayed through Iran's activities. That's why we're worried about it. There's always that link. But we need to get rid of the nuclear weapons, but we also need to get rid of the nuclear power. It is a question of political will. I would encourage your listeners to visit both PSR's website, PSR.org, and also beyondnuclear.org. You can find my Michigan speaking schedule there. And you can also find out lots of other information. Join our email list, join our organizations, help mobilize the public voice to speak out against this, because Fukushima shows that the entire environment is being dosed with radioactivity. And the official scientific body of the United Nations, Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation, the summary of their report, which will be issued within a few months, concludes that from the Fukushima accident, there are, quote, no discernible effects.
Hmm.
It says that the radiation is barely above background radiation, and that the biggest health problem is fear, to be worried about this. And yet, 10 days after Fukushima blew up, there was radioactivity from Fukushima in the milk in Boston, Massachusetts. Now, our EPA said, but not so much to be worried about. But that's not good enough for me. If you're telling me it's in the milk, but don't worry, there's not enough, somebody's still going to get it in their glass of milk or their cup of ice cream or yogurt. And for those poor souls who do get it, it's a very big deal. So the political fight is really in all realms. The Abe government in Japan is planning to have the Olympics in Tokyo in 2020. I'm flabbergasted at what a gambler he is. The likelihood of there being another catastrophic situation at the Fukushima Daiichi plants in Japan with great releases of radioactivity is very, very high. But he's willing to bet that it won't be before 2020.
You know, I can't imagine that anyone that's listening to this broadcast isn't concerned, and maybe, like I am, frightened at what you sketch out here. But there's something that doesn't allow this to be mobilized into great public sentiment, and there's not, for instance, the people that care about themselves, their communities, their children, their children's children aren't participating in this activity. What's happened? And I think the genius, the evil genius of people like these Koch brothers that have so much invested in the old technology of energy production, they've mobilized a movement not saying, hey, we want to keep burning coal and polluting the atmosphere and poisoning everybody. We're spending our tens of millions of dollars in the political arena to stop this communist Muslim president who's trying to take away our freedom with a health care, with a very tepid health care program. And it's been successful in many ways. And they've been able to elect candidates that will that see the like EPA rules as that are being proposed that could, I said 100 plants, apparently it could. There's 600 coal-fired power plants, and hundreds of them could be shut with these new EPA rules. And this is what this money is being spent for, ultimately, by the Koch brothers, to not allow a single one. They want to conserve what is. They are conservatives in the best, and I guess I would say the worst sense of the word.
Well, your oil companies.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Did I forget the oil companies? Yes, go ahead.
And your fracking companies, yeah. They're making money hand over fist.
Right.
We're paying high energy prices, and but we're killing ourselves and our planet. And we're going to need, if we continue burning coal, we're going to need a lot more health care.
But it's the death of a thousand. It's the death of a thousand cuts, so it doesn't mobilize people.
Well, but I think this is how I describe something like Fukushima. You know, we all know that an atom bomb can vaporize a city in a second, and it's very fearful to us, that image, as it should be. But this, for instance, the fact that a normally operating nuclear power plant, Fermi 2, for instance, in your neighborhood, regularly releases radioactivity. Small amounts, but regularly done. And we don't really know exactly what that does to us, but we know that all radioactivity increases risk of disease.
Sure.
So we feel it's really very ill-advised to operate these reactors any longer whatsoever, and certainly not to build new ones.
Let me ask you a final question, because we're almost out of time. And if I say to any guest, are you hopeful? I mean, it's not like a guest is going to say, no, I think the whole situation is hopeless, because for one thing, nobody would participate in any of the activities or come to your lectures or anything like that. But are you hopeful that we can do something besides being motivated by a catastrophe like Fukushima? I'm fearful that it will take some really horrible accident before people will get a clue what's going on.
Well, I am hopeful. I'm hopeful that we can promote an idea of a renewable energy supply system that will bring us new technology, new jobs, and a cleaner, more healthy, more secure energy supply. It's going to take a paradigm shift. We have to think of not having huge, massive, centralized distribution, generation stations, but rather more distributed generation stations, for one idea. But I'm very optimistic that this can happen. It's something like the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair is an example of this. It's very non-corporate, but it's a huge, there's something like 25,000 people there in the center of, Wisconsin last summer. Dealing with wind turbines and solar panels and other ways to generate electricity without burning fossil fuels. I'm also encouraged by it is a David and Goliath setup. Groups like Beyond Nuclear and PSR have relatively very small budgets, especially compared to the Nuclear Energy Institute and the other industry advocates. But the small group of people has been able to achieve many, many victories. For instance...
Well, let me stop you at the for instance, because we are absolutely out of time. And there's so much more that Alfred Meyer has to tell us. He's on the National Board of Directors of the Physicians for Social Responsibility. And he's going to be in our state between February 12th and 17th, including in the area around us, Ferndale, Monroe, and Ann Arbor. And you can go to PSR.org, also BeyondNuclear.org. And as they used to say, maybe people still do say it, better active today than radioactive tomorrow. Alfred Meyer, thanks so much for being on the broadcast.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be back with another guest in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call.
I'm John Amos with another story about the legacy of Montford Point Marines. They were lawyers, laborers, doctors, and teachers. There was a martial arts instructor among them, as well as seasoned veterans of the Army and the Navy. At Montford Point, they were all Marines. They ran, they trained, they endured the toughest of drill instructors, homesickness, and racism that couldn't accept a black man in a Marine uniform. Still, they took on the challenge of training that would prove them more than worthy to call themselves the few, the proud, the Marines.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Valentine's Day is right around the corner. Pro Flowers has a special offer for one dozen long-stem assorted roses, plus an upgraded vase, plus free chocolates, all for just $29.99. Click the banner now or go to proflowers.com, click the blue microphone in the top right corner, and enter code RIBBON. Order today for guaranteed Valentine's Day delivery. That's proflowers.com, click the mic, and enter RIBBON for this exclusive deal.
When I grow up, I want to be a new pair of blue jeans.
When I grow up, I want to be a kid's first computer.
When I grow up, I want to be a glass countertop in a new home.
When I grow up, I want to be a kid's best birthday present.
When I grow up, I want to be a
football stadium.
When I grow up, I want to be a warm place on a cold day.
When I grow up, I want to be a fancy backsplash.
I want to be a bike that races around the
country. When I grow up, I want to be a bench on a forest
trail. When I grow up, I want to be a rocking chair on
when
a sunny porch.
I want to be a skyscraper.
I want to be
a...
When I grow up, I don't want to be a piece of garbage. And if you recycle me, I won't be.
Give your garbage another life. Recycle. Learn how at iwanttoberecycled.org. A public service advertisement brought to you by Keep America Beautiful and the Ad Council.
This is your Car Care Minute. Email, texting, and Twitter are some of today's communication tools. But when it comes to vehicle repair or service, a face-to-face meeting with your automotive technician is still the best method of communication to ensure a satisfactory service. But do your homework before taking your vehicle in for repairs or service. Read your owner's manual. Make a written list of your vehicle's dashboard warning signals or changes in performance and handling. Go through your list with the technician or service consultant. Let them diagnose and recommend a remedy. But do ask questions regarding the costs before work begins. Two-way communication. It's the key to better automotive service. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Detroit, a union town. It was always known as that in a lot of the history of unions. They go way back, but contemporary history really begins with the sit-ins in Flint and Walter Reuther, the United Auto Workers, and all of that. And it's kind of like a golden age of unions. But besides unions being battered lately, losing members, representing such a small portion of particularly of private businesses, they certainly have fallen on dark days, even to the point where people in the working class, in the middle class, that owe so much to the union movement for creating middle class standards of living for that sector of the population. I hear on the talk shows that I do, well, unions were good when my dad needed them. Or they are really what caused Detroit to go broke. Oh, they have such large pension demands that they've really become a negative on our economy. Well, how about this? Save Our Unions. That's what Steve Early says. That's the name of his latest book. Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. And you may remember Steve Early. He's been on my show at least a couple of times. He did Civil Wars in U.S. Labor. Unions actually fighting one another, embedded with organized labor as well. And he's written for lots of publications, some of my favorites, like The Nation and The Progressive, some of my non-favorites, although I read them, The New York Times and The Wall Street Journal. And he describes himself as an organizer, a strike strategist, a labor educator, and he's a lawyer as well. And he just recently retired from his job as a national staff member of the Communication Workers of America, the CWA. And full disclosure, I'm a longtime member of an AFL-CIO union, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. So, yes, I do have a dog in this fight. Steve Early, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, you know, it depends on how you look at the political spectrum, the criticisms that people have from the right, certainly people from the left like myself that have criticisms of unions, and I know you do, and people, probably the great mass of people in the middle to which the unions are becoming less and less relevant. So tell us about your book, Save Our Unions. It almost sounds desperate, like we've got to go out and get a drowning person.
It does have a bit of a plaintive tone to it, the title. Well, the material in the book is reporting and commentaries, articles that I've done over the last few years as a freelance labor journalist. It addresses some of the key challenges facing organized labor, organizing new members, resisting contract concessions, winning strikes, and developing greater independence in politics from the Democratic Party, which I think is really essential if unions are going to revive. There's an emphasis, you know, that is rooted in my own 42-year experience in the labor movement on the importance of union democracy and reform struggles. Unions are not perfect. They're human institutions. Sometimes they can misbehave, and the best way of getting them on track, making them more effective as defenders of workers' rights, is for the members to be actively involved, to make sure that they participate, that they elect good leaders, and that they keep those leaders accountable and make sure that their dues money is spent properly. So a good part of the book is also devoted to efforts, examples of efforts of union members struggling to make unions like the Teamsters and the Machinists and the mine workers, other major unions, more accountable to the rank and file.
Well, Steve Early, when we think about our audience, maybe you have the exact percentage, but of in the private sector and in the public sector as well, probably the percentage listening to this, because we're in Detroit, is a little greater. But still, if it was 20%, it would probably be pretty high. So we got 80% of the people listening that were thinking, who cares? You know, you know, unions, good, bad, left, right, disappearing, or doesn't have anything to do with me. Why should I care?
Well, I think it's an understandable reaction given the fact that we are down overall to only one out of every 10 workers having a union card, having the protection of a union contract, having greater rights on the job than state and federal law provide. But let's start right there. If we did not have a labor movement in this country lobbying for all workers, not just those reduced-paying members, we wouldn't have had 100 years ago child labor laws. We wouldn't have had the first state laws providing compensation where people are injured on the job. In the 1930s, we wouldn't have had the unemployment insurance system created that has benefited tens of millions of unemployed workers since then. We wouldn't have had the 40-hour week and overtime requirements. There never would have been a Social Security system. We never would have had Medicare or Medicaid if it hadn't been for labor movement lobbying. We never would have had national laws protecting people's pensions, trying to set workplace safety standards, Family, Medical, and Leave Act, all the anti-discrimination statutes that protect people against discrimination in employment based on race and gender and age, disability, all were a product of labor movement lobbying. And today, you know, you see unions lobbying for paid sick days, for higher minimum wages. You know, those aren't things that necessarily benefit people with good union contracts. They're mainly going to benefit non-union workers. So if you took the labor movement out of the equation, workers in this country would have even fewer rights. Their standard of living would be even lower, and many would be in very serious economic straits, not that they are not today in many communities.
Well, let me play the devil's advocate. So, okay, that's good. I didn't know all that. I mean, I did, but I'm being the devil's advocate. I didn't know all that, but boy, that's great. What a great history labor unions have of coming to bat for the average person. And actually, there is no other organized political force that does that. So what a role they played in the past. Now, though, unions can be a real impediment to cities staying out of bankruptcy like Detroit, which some people blame on the unions, or the short falls in budgets for states like in Wisconsin. And now, in Chattanooga, where there's a VW plant, the UAW looks like, with the cooperation of the VW company of Germany, is going to agree to the first labor contract with a foreign manufacturer. And the Republican, well, let's say just the business community there and its representatives, the senators, the mayor of Chattanooga, say this is going to be horrible because we're not going to be competitive anymore. So thank you, unions, for everything you've done in the past, but now we don't need you anymore because you are actually forcing us into a position where we're going to be non-competitive.
Well, that's an interesting example because two German companies involved, obviously Daimler in Alabama and Volkswagen in Chattanooga, these are global companies. They're heavily unionized in Germany. Workers have much stronger social program protections and wages and benefits than workers in auto plants in the South. Volkswagen's unions in Germany have helped the UAW with this campaign. They've made the point that if the company can afford to pay decent wages and benefits and agree to a union contract and give workers a voice in Germany, why not in Tennessee? You know, I think this particular effort is a really important example of how in a global economy, unions, workers in one country have to help out workers in another. And the local business community, local conservative groups who are agitating against this, I don't think are really speaking on behalf of the majority of the workers in that Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga. I mean, we'll see. There's going to be a vote conducted later this month by the National Labor Relations Board, but it looks to me like the UAW has done its work in the plant and built the kind of international labor solidarity that is going to enable workers down there to have the same voice on the job that Volkswagen workers do in Germany.
Steve Early is the author of Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. It's published by Monthly Review Press, and you can go to monthlyreview.org, but you can also go to Steve's website at steveearly.org. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E. What about the idea that unions have really priced themselves out of the market by what right-wing critics say is unreasonable pay demands and particularly benefits and pensions that leave cities like Detroit holding a bag that doesn't hold water? That's a lot of mixed metaphor there, isn't it? But I think you know what I mean. That's it. The market should be what, like everything else, should be what determines the selling price of labor, not artificially raised.
Well, I mean, that's a great argument if you're a superstar professional athlete or the CEO of a company looking to get a job at the same level in the corporate hierarchy elsewhere in the business world. Individual workers, particularly in low-wage jobs, don't have a lot of leverage in dealing with their employers. And if they don't band together in some fashion, doesn't always have to be a union. It can sometimes be a more informal group. We've seen some examples recently of the Fight for 15 campaign among fast food workers, Our Walmart, which is an association of workers at Walmart trying to improve the treatment of employees there, but not making any demands for collective bargaining or unionization as a short-term goal. These are people sticking up for their rights, sharing information, petitioning their employers for changes and improvements on the job. This is where most of the workplace organizing activity is going on at the moment, and I don't think any of it threatens to drive employers out of business. It's designed by workers themselves to get themselves a better deal at work. One of the problems with all those state and federal laws that I was talking about before is it's hard to enforce them if you don't have some organizational backing, if you don't have an association of workers or a union assisting you. You'd have to go out and hire a private attorney. That's expensive. One of the benefits of having an employee association of some sort, whether at Walmart, in the fast food industry, in the auto industry, any industry, is the benefit of pooling resources and getting collective representation. I think there's still a big role for that, and that's why workers continue to organize and struggle and build organizations like that.
You know, it's interesting, the pay scales that always shock me. When I was talking on one of my phone-in talk shows about this movement for $15 an hour, I think I'm trying to remember the website, something like just 15.org, but there may be something else. But if you look up $15 an hour on the internet, you'll find that. And so people started calling. A guy said, I'm EMS, emergency medical service, and I'm getting $9 an hour. I'm thinking, $9 an hour? I'm going to have a heart attack or get hit by a car? And this guy should be getting $30 an hour easily. And speak to this, if you would, a little, Steve Early. When I say the largest party in this country is not the Democrats or the Republicans, but it's the party of resentment. And so it wasn't so much that the EMS guy calling in said, wow, I ought to be, if yeah, I support fast food workers getting $15 an hour, but I should be getting 30 given the critical work that I do. So there's just this resentment, and non-union workers resent unionized workers, and on it goes.
It is a phenomena, and it's one that powerful forces on the right and corporations and Republican Party certainly try to stir up. It's kind of a divide-and-conquer tactic to encourage what in Ireland is called begrudgery, someone a rung or two down social and economic ladder, rather than being upset about the people at the top of the heap, resents those just a rung or two above them and tries to pull them down. Not really the most effective strategy for improving the lot of the working class majority in any country. But it's a phenomenon that unions have to address. I mean, if unions are perceived, whether they're teachers' unions or police or firefighters' unions or even some private sector unions, as defenders of narrow special interests, rather than defenders of the whole working class, fighting for improvements for everybody, it's going to be much easier for them to be isolated, to be marginalized, and to be defeated and attacked. And we see that happening in some places. You know, there are unions that have gone on the offensive. The Chicago Teachers is one great example. In 2012, they waged a strike that was very clearly not just about improvements for their own members. It was about trying to improve the quality of public education in Chicago, smaller class sizes, more teachers, more resources for the schools. And because they had done their work in the community, they received very strong support from parents and teachers and church groups and defeated the attempt by the mayor and the school board in Chicago to scapegoat them and to strip them of rights and benefits that make teaching an attractive profession. And we want people to go into it, which you know, is a big problem today when teachers, among other public employees, are so much criticized and blamed and demonized.
Steve Early, let's, and we haven't done this yet, let's delve into some of the essays that you've collected in your book, Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. And there are so many, I almost feel like asking you which is your favorite, because I know that when I write, I always say, boy, this is great, and some of them, you know, are good. But there's some that I thought if someone said to me, all right, pick out one essay that you've written, Peter, over the years you'd like to give to people, I think I know which one. But and maybe that's not fair, because you have, I can't even tell, maybe 30 or something like that, or maybe more.
There is one that's kind of a favorite. It's about a local union in Boston, a telephone workers local affiliated with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers local 2222 in Dorchester, Mass., which is a neighborhood in Boston. And it's really a profile of how that local has functioned over the years as kind of a culture of solidarity. A lot of people outside the labor movement, you know, think of unions as just another business. They provide a service for a fee. You know, it's like an insurance company. The reality is quite different. I mean, unions are at their best a family. They're like a counterculture where people kind of stick together and look out for each other. And in this piece in the book, I describe the many different programs that this particular union local has to help people when they have a family emergency, when they have a drug or alcohol problem, when their job is in jeopardy. You know, a lot of the things that unions do get very little publicity in the mainstream media, but they're a very important part of creating a kind of haven in a heartless neoliberal world. So I think, you know, readers might be interested in this particular profile of what a model local does to help members and their families, both on the job and in the community.
Yeah, and you used a phrase which maybe needs a bit of explaining, neoliberal. It's different than one would think of as a liberal political philosophy, right?
Yeah, it's not my favorite label, but it's a popular one. Basically, you know, a world of hostile kind of corporations and hostile government agencies, you know, where people are supposed to survive through dog eat dog. You know, at their best, as I said, unions are about mutual aid and protection, about creating a community. Now, other institutions in our society do that, community organizations, churches, you know, 12-step programs provide important support for many people. But unions, you know, also play this important economic and political role. They protect people on the job, help them exercise their rights as workers, help them lobby for programs that benefit both union members and all workers. So I think they're really central to any kind of decent, just, and democratic society. If they're exterminated, let me tell you, the only winners will be, big business and their Republican allies, and everybody else will be the worse off.
Well, you at the beginning of the show, Steve Early, talked about independence from the Democratic Party. I would think that the millions and tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars that unions spend to get Democratic candidates elected, from my union dues and yours and the rest of the people that are in unions here, and they don't get much bang for their buck. I think it was in Illinois a few years ago that the state AFL had spent, I don't know, something like $15 million, and they had a 13-point labor agenda. They got their candidates elected, and they didn't get a single one of them realized. But on the other hand, you think, well, what are they going to do? Just let the Republicans get in? I always say, you know, the Democrats, best I can say about them, they're better than a stick in the eye, and the Republicans are a stick in the eye of the average person. So what do we do? We're sort of trapped into that two-party system.
It very definitely is a box, and it's very constraining, and partly it has to do with the kind of structure of our electoral system. But I think one encouraging sign is the degree to which unions, in their current desperate circumstances, are taking some chances lately and backing some independent candidates and running union members themselves. Out in Seattle, we have the inspiring example of a young community college teacher, Kashama Sawant, who just became the first socialist elected to city government in 100 years. She's a Seattle City Council member, and she won by campaigning on behalf of the Fight for 15, supporting the Boeing workers, embracing a whole range of labor causes that her centrist Democrat incumbent opponent was much more tepid about. In Lorain, Ohio, we just had 20 union members run for the city council because they were disgusted with the way that incumbent Democrats that they had long supported basically abandoned any commitment to sticking up for workers. In the book, I mentioned the example of the Vermont Progressive Party, which is one of the most viable and successful state-level third parties in the country, has representation in both houses of the state legislature. Over the last 10 years, unions in Vermont have moved to support Progressive Party candidates broken with the Democrats in key races, and that's because the third party there has been built around a solid track record of supporting workers' issues. And I think we need two, three many examples of that in other states.
You mentioned Detroit in your book, and particularly Chris Romberg's book, The Broken Table, the Detroit newspaper strike and the state of American labor. That was a strike that went on from 1995 to 2000 and pretty much was won by the companies. And I know we talked before the broadcast about you've been reading a lot about Detroit. You've got a whole audience of Detroiters, and we kind of look back, and your book is Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress, and I think people are feeling that distress. Any word to them?
Well, certainly in Detroit, as there has been in other Midwestern cities, there's been some exciting organizing among fast food workers. The Restaurant Opportunity Center has been helping restaurant workers achieve better working conditions and in a variety of restaurant industry outlets. Our Walmart, certainly out here in California where I live, has been very active, and at the level of individual Walmart stores and warehouses has won some important concessions from the company. I think if people give in to despair and apathy and hopelessness, it's understandable, but it's not a way forward. And if they talk to their coworkers, contact one of these worker advocacy groups in their own area. Another great organization in Detroit is Labor Notes. I think that they'll find there are other like-minded people who want to join together and fight for a better deal for workers and their families. Obviously, in Detroit, with the bankruptcy challenge and the pressure on public employee pensions and contracts, you have a very, very difficult situation to navigate.
We just have a minute or two left. Maybe this isn't the best last question. What I worry about is that the industries that are being organized now, the fast food workers, just don't have either the social or economic clout that the big companies did that were first unionized in the last century, you know, steel. I mean, all the basis of industrial capitalism. And sure, the baristas and all those folks and the EMS guy all deserve better wages. Is there enough there, though, actually to save our unions and bring it out of distress, as your title of your book suggests?
I think you make a very good point, and that's why in the book, again, drawing my own experience in the telephone industry, I stress the importance of continued union building within major corporations like Verizon, like AT&T, like Boeing out in Seattle, like the big three in auto. You know, these are the companies that are still major players in the global economy, still at least partially unionized, and we have to build on the base of union members and the labor standards that have been created in these industries over many years if workers in other industries like fast food are going to benefit long term.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the broadcast again, Steve Early. Always a pleasure to talk to you. The book is Save Our Unions. It's the newest one from Steve. Subtitled Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. I would just add, well, I can't remember who said the old phrase, we must either hang together or we will hang separately. And I think this economically, that's what we're facing. The book is published by Monthly Review Press. You can go to monthlyreview.org. And Steve has his own website. It's steveearly.org. And you can also go to my website where there'll be a link. It's Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Steve Early, thanks again for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or sponsors of WRIF Radio or of its parent company, Greater Media Incorporated. Stay tuned. There's more rock coming right up on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. Night Call. Night Call.
Valentine's Day is right around the corner. Pro Flowers has a special offer for one dozen long-stem assorted roses, plus an upgraded vase, plus free chocolates, all for just $29.99. Click the banner now or go to proflowers.com. Click the blue microphone in the top right corner and enter code RIBBON. Order today for guaranteed Valentine's Day delivery. That's proflowers.com. Click the mic and enter RIBBON for this exclusive deal.
During these tough economic times when many families are living paycheck to paycheck, it can be easy to lose sight of the importance of saving for the future. The National Foundation for Credit Counseling wants you to know there are some simple steps you can take to set aside dollars each month for retirement, college tuition, or unexpected expenses that could come your way. Most important is to review all your expenses and establish a monthly budget. Then examine every spending category and cut 10% from each. You can't reduce fixed expenses like rent or mortgage or a car payment, but you can easily cut back in many other areas, like entertainment, or using mass transit when possible instead of driving. And take a look at trying to bundle services such as your cell phone, land phone, cable TV, and internet service. For more tips and to speak with a certified credit counselor who can start you on the right track, call the NFCC at 800-388-2227 or visit debtadvice.org. This has been a public service message from the National Foundation for Credit Counseling.
Our son would go from "Good morning, Mom," to words you'd never expect to come out of your child's mouth. Our pain came from not knowing what to do. He was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. 5 or 6 years later, he was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. I think the hardest part of living with someone who has a mental illness is thinking that you're alone, that no one else could understand. NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, is made up of people who live it every day. We lean on each other and we learn from each other. NAMI doesn't let anyone give up hope. My name is Mary Tadigan, and I can tell you what NAMI has meant for my family. It has meant that we are a family.
1 in 5 adults lives with depression, schizophrenia, anxiety, or other mental illnesses. NAMI provides education and support to these families and individuals. To find a local chapter, go to NAMI.org or call 800-950-NAMI.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Lovely crew. See them here, see them there. Get all the details online at WRIF.com.
I am immortal. I'll never fade away. I'm a legacy that lives beyond, far beyond the grave. I am immortal. I'll never rest in peace. And you're never gonna be.